This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another rousing edition of this show that is still on the air despite last week's uploads. We are the Hard Travelers.
To be fair, it was mostly last week's upload that was in danger of getting us canceled.
Yes, and load is a good term for it because it was a load of, well, quite frankly, some might suggest a unique entity. If you survived the draft and pitches podcasts, we salute you, and we hope that you haven't given up on us forever, which if you're listening to this, you clearly haven't. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I'm Greg Phillips. Joining me as always in our luxurious studios in Vancouver, British Columbia, is Nick Duke. Nick, how are you, my good man?
I'm doing pretty well. My voice is a little under the weather this week, but I'm going to, you know, sometimes you got to work hurt, Greg. You don't have to work injured, but sometimes you got to work hurt.
That's right, yeah. But Frank, Cowboy would throw you out there. He'd take the mats off the floor, and he'd get pissed at you for getting hurt. And it was your fault.
That was the problem, is I tried to, I attempted to use my voice off the top rope, and that's how I got injured.
So. Automatic disqualification.
Indeed.
Yes. As for me, I had a pretty good week. I faded away and classified myself as obsolete.
I knew you were going to do it. I knew you were going to find a way.
Well, quite frankly, listen, you've been living your whole life not being obsolete, and you don't know how refreshing it is to be obsolete. You don't know.
I don't know.
If you would just delete yourself, fade away, and become obsolete, you too could join the broken brilliance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You could. You have that ability.
But the broken brilliance is not obsolete, though.
No, but he renders you obsolete, and it makes your life better when he does it. He is. Mm-hmm. He fixed all of the errors in Brother Nero's life. He healed his addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's true.
You know, it's a good thing. And of course, you know, we told you the last time we talked to you, we weren't able to do it last week, obviously, because we. You know, not to tell tales out of school, but as you may have noticed, we recorded those podcasts a few months in advance, but we've got to give you what everyone's been waiting for the last 2 weeks with bated breath. I know I've been waiting on talking about it with bated breath, and that, of course, is the hard-traveling fantasy football update.
Do we really even want to talk about that?
Listen, we need to let the people know. The people want to know how the hard-traveling fanboys are faring in their fantasy seasons to this point.
Well, quite frankly, some might suggest that for years the hard-traveling fanboys have established a pattern of dominance. And
that's true.
Even the greatest, you know, have a down year once in a while.
Sometimes there's a hiccup in the plan.
You know?
As you said.
Even Kevin Nash drew, you know, less than 100 million every once in a while, Greg.
That's right. That's exactly right. And for those of you who may not know, and most of you don't because we haven't advertised it, but quite frankly, Greg Phillips, that's me, and the Prestigia, as well as Nick Duke's Hilton Hulkamaniacs, we're sitting at 1-3 right now.
Yep.
1-3. You know, not quite in the cellar, thanks to a team called Bullet Club.
All right,
but we are pretty low in the league.
I think he's the only person that we're ahead of.
That's correct. I am ranked 10th. Nick is ranked 11th.
Yep. There
and,
you go.
You know, it's the season's young. I'm going to quote Mr. Duke from years ago. It's a marathon, not a sprint.
That's right.
There's no reason why the hard traveling fanboys can't work our way up and finish. At least finish, you know, 7th or 6th, maybe.
We're going to turn it around. I have faith we're going to turn it around.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I actually won this week, my first game. I broke out of the 0-3 cellar, thanks to a rousing performance from Matt Ryan. Nick Duke's beloved quarterback, and also Mr. Russell Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Wilson Phillips fame. So,
quite frankly.
You know, we'll keep you updated with that exciting update as the season progresses.
Yes, this was clearly the most thrilling 120 seconds of our show that we've ever had.
And we'll keep doing this until we come in across something else like the Ho-Ho Loon ticker that can become our new gimmick. for the time being, let's move on to your favorite segment and mine. What you reading? What you watching? So,
we're 6 months in and we still don't have a jingle? I thought there was a jingle in the works. Like
David Sunday was supposed to be working on a jingle, but it's turned into like Dr. Dre's last album where it's just never going to happen.
Hey, that finally happened though.
I like to imagine it didn't.
Hey, it wasn't that bad. Did you ever listen to it?
No, I never did, actually.
Well, then why would you want to imagine that it didn't happen?
But simply because I feel like the mythology, there's no way it can live up to, 15 years of...
Well, true. But it was a solid album, nonetheless, in my opinion.
Well, maybe it is. I need to listen
to it. But that's not for me to say.
Not for you to say, quite frankly. Listen, you're not creative.
I'm not.
Now, anyway...
Now, granted, it didn't have any tracks that were quite on the level of my ass, but still
has had a track on that level.
Still some solid stuff on there, in my opinion.
But you know, this is a rarity of an episode because for once I'm actually over prepared for this episode.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and I should have mentioned at the top of the show, this is of course off the page, and this is a look back at the very first episode of The Walking Dead, one of the most popular shows.
We're doing that because this is, of course, the first episode in our month-long series of Walking Dead shows, where every show of the month of October will have a special Walking Dead theme to celebrate the return of the show, which is, I'm not sure the exact numbers, but still wildly popular.
It's one of the most popular shows on television, if not the, at the moment. So, certainly, we're looking forward to digging into that episode and digging into the mythos of The Walking Dead this month, and hopefully can produce some insights for you as well. Now, but before we get to that, like I said, this is reading and watching, and I, for once, am not only prepared, I'm over-prepared. I have had 2 weeks now to get ready for this, and I've read 13 comics in that time period, which is, for those of you who don't know, for Nick, that wouldn't be very impressive. For me, that's very impressive because I read very slowly. So I have gotten...
Greg literally reads each page twice.
Yes, I do. Absolutely. I don't know why. I've just always done it that way. It helps me absorb the details and process everything that's going on better, I think. But in any event, I'm finally through 13 comics in 2 weeks, and I feel prepared for the reading segment. As for the watching segment, really haven't watched a lot other than The Walking Dead to get ready for this episode. So I will turn it over to Nick and ask what you've been watching.
Not much. You know, still, I think as we're recording this right now, The Flash is airing its season 3 premiere. The only thing I've been watching is I've been trying feverishly to get caught up on Supergirl before it returns next week. I'm trying to finish off the end of season 1. I got one episode. I got the season finale of season 1 left to finish. So I've probably watched in the last 2 weeks probably 4 or 5 episodes somewhere in that range. I've been working my way through it over the past, I don't know, 2 months or so, and I'm finally close to getting caught up. And I
understand you have some thoughts on it.
Yeah, I've really liked it. A lot more than I thought I would. I know that I watched the first 4 or 5 episodes, not as they aired, but within like a week of airing on DVR and stuff, and then kind of fell behind, and you know, as I often do with a lot of shows, and had a big backlog to get through. And I know after the first 4 or 5 episodes, I just wasn't feeling it, to be honest. I thought a lot of the characters were just annoying and not very compelling. The only characters I really cared about from the beginning were Kara and her sister Alex. But I got to say, the show really, really improved over the course of the season. And by the end, now granted, I still got to finish off the season finale. But in my opinion, I think it was probably, if you're looking at, if you're comparing it to the four CW shows, because it's moving to the CW now, I think it was probably the second strongest of the four last season. Flash obviously had a great season. Arrow had its worst season, you know, in the show's history. And Legends I liked, but I thought Legends had some episodes that were just filler. And the show, that show really didn't hit its peak until, you know, the last four or five episodes, which is, you know, which is fine. I certainly enjoyed Legends, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do by expanding it to a full season and, you know, having time to establish the characters and whatnot. But I gotta say, I think Supergirl just did a really good job of steadily improving as it went along and making me care about characters that I didn't at the beginning, like, you know, Wynn or Cat Grant or Lucy Lane or the Hank Henshaw / spoiler Martian Manhunter stuff was just phenomenal. Loved everything about that character. Still don't give a damn about James Olsen and hope that he can be a casualty at some point, but sadly, I'm afraid
they're stuck with him now.
Yes. And may I suggest that if they were to get rid of him, though, and they wanted to introduce a real Jimmy Olsen, I think you and I both know a certain bespectacled, redheaded sir, a friend of ours, who would be a great choice to play.
He would be an amazing choice to play Jimmy Olsen.
Jimmy Olsen?
He regularly says things like wowzers.
Yeah. Unironically.
Yes. I mean,
and the great thing is he sometimes he dresses like Jimmy Olsen did back in the 1950s, so you have that tie there.
Oh yes, so that would be awesome, and I'm really, I mean, you know, and I'm glad to hear you like the show, because actually I was talking to that mutual friend, and we were both just astonished that you liked this show, because I thought for sure you'd hate it, knowing your personality and what you look for in your comic book media and things like that. I was like, oh, Nick's gonna hate this show, because even I like it, but I don't love it. Like, it's still not – there were episodes that I thought were great, but it's still not, you know, just can't-miss TV for me. But I enjoy the show. I think James Olsen is probably my biggest hang-up at this point. And I'm not a big Cat Grant fan either, to be honest. But I love Kara – or Kara. I love Melissa Benoist's performance of her. She's perfect as that character. Wynn I like a lot. Lucy I like a lot. The sister I like a lot. Of course, Henshaw is phenomenal. And Non is really good, too. Even though it's a different take on Non.
Yeah, I gotta finish out the last episodes. I'm holding out hope for a lobotomy of some sort, but I'm not getting my hopes up on that front.
Yeah, I think both of us are impressed that Supergirl managed to improve itself over the course of the season.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, it's not, you know, obviously, it's not my preferred tone or take on a comic book television show, but I think what I appreciate about it so much is, while it may not be the tone I prefer, I think they execute that tone very consistent manner. They do it very well. Like, Arrow is more of my tone, you know, but the last, you know, we both really enjoyed season three,
right,
more than most people did.
Yep.
But I would agree it started to stray a little bit from what I like about the show. And then season four was just a complete departure and got to a point where it wasn't executing its tone very well. It wasn't executing the plays that were called, Greg. And at that point, you've got a problem.
The fans weren't buying the attraction.
But I'm hopeful that Arrow's going to bounce back in season five. I've got faith.
The trailers look awesome so far.
The trailers look great. Looking forward to Legends, looking forward to Supergirl season two.
Yep, Supergirl's going to be good. Yep.
Flash, of course, you know, should continue to be awesome. So, yeah, we'll have thoughts on The Flash, I'm sure, on next week's show.
That's right. Deep thoughts, even. Yeah, so that's good. I'm still working my way through Daredevil Season 2 before I can start on Luke Cage. And
I think I'm three or four episodes in. I saw the episode with the rooftop conversation.
Yes.
Which was a great episode, yep, by the way. And that's where I'm at. Yeah, you and I have not yet torn through Luke Cage like so much of the world, so I'm having to avoid spoilers like crazy.
Yeah, me too. But I will say this. My only thoughts on Daredevil Season 2 to the point where I'm at right now that I want to talk about before I can get into more detail of the things that I am enjoying. It's time for Karen Page to meet Bullseye.
Wow. That's
that's how annoying she is.
I gotta see the rest of the season, but
Tim Capel put it best at one point.
Taking the knowledge that I have to this point, I find that difficult to believe.
To each their own, Nicholas. But
now, granted, all I've got is season one plus three episodes.
Oh yeah, and you know I loved her in season one. I thought she was awesome in season one, but season two, nah, I'm pretty much
she's
over.
She's been fine through the first three episodes. I mean, nothing.
Crying in every episode, no doubt.
Listen to you.
You know, there's stuff that I'm enjoying, but overall, not even close to season one in my opinion. Punisher is the best part for me. But all of that aside, let's get into the meat of this segment. What you reading? Because both of us have been reading, am I correct?
Yeah, I'll throw real quick just a little short mini plug. Not so much reading. I've been listening to the audiobook version of Marvel Comics, The Untold History or The Untold Story or whatever it's called. It's basically a very, very long and in-depth history of Marvel from basically the early days of the Fantastic Four up through modern times. And, you know, we won't get into all the gory details and stuff because you could honestly do an entire podcast on the book, but suffice it to say, it's a very intriguing look at the formation of how Marvel became what we know it to be today, especially if you aren't well-versed in your bullshit politics in the back, brother.
Yes. Now, was everything that happened at Marvel in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, was it all on the format sheet?
No, none of it. It was not. This is off the format sheet, folks.
Wow. That sounds like must-read material there. I'm very fascinated in the history of comics. And one of the things you and I talked about off the air was how that the early days of comics, and you know, we've talked about this with the other staff here at Place to Be Nation as well, the early days of the comics industry, whether you want to go back to the 30s and 40s or whether you wanted to just start it in the Marvel age of the 60s, would make for an amazing cable television show, something like Mad Men.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. You need a great Stan Lee impersonator, though.
I wonder where they could find someone that can do a Stan Lee impression. I'll have to look into it.
I'm not giving you the segue.
Give me the segue.
If you want to do it, you just have to do it cold. You're gonna have to go in dry.
I'm gonna. That's not good for anyone, Nick. I'm gonna. You know, I'm gonna hold off on it for now. I'm gonna drop it in maybe when you least expect it, or maybe not at all.
I don't believe you.
Who knows? Let's get into the meat of the matter here. Our top three books of the week. We're gonna kick off with that as we.
It will be the top three books of the last 2 weeks.
The last 2 weeks, and for me, Nick, as you know, it's really the top three books of the last
6 months.
The last roughly month and a half or so. There's books from a month and a half ago that I've just now recently read, so I'm way behind on virtually everything. Some books I'm closer than others to catching up. But do you want to kick off or should I?
No, I'll let you go first since you've got so many to talk about.
All right. This was a big struggle for me to pick my number three book because there are two that I have sitting here that I'm looking at right now. If I'm being honest, one of them was a little bit better than the other one overall, so I'm going to have to put this one aside for now, but I'll mention it in my quick hits for sure. So my number three book of this time period was Aquaman number 4 by Dan Abnett and Rob Briones. This has been a while since you've read it, Nick, but this is the issue, if you recall, where Arthur spends the entire time behind bars. He's being held in a government holding facility. Meanwhile, Mira is trying to negotiate with this government agent named Gantry for Arthur's release. Arthur is trying to argue with the authorities about how he's no threat to them, and he wants to help them unfurl the mystery of who's trying to start a war between Atlantis and America. And meanwhile, the forces of Atlantis are investigating that very thing. And Black Manta is negotiating with the forces of Nemo. They're trying to get him to join their organization. So it's basically an entire issue of hardly any action at all. There's barely any action. I don't know that there's a punch thrown the entire issue. Maybe one. And it's just talking. And for a lot of people, that's a turnoff in superhero comics, and I get that. But in this case, I think it works because it's so different from what you expect. I think of all the characters in the Rebirth Initiative, Aquaman has actually been the best superhero of all of them because he is the superhero who views violence, who is a kind of a flip on the traditional take on Aquaman in that he views violence as a last resort. He is trying everything in his power not to come down on these people, and he's just continuing to be pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed, and they keep poking the bear, and eventually the bear is going to poke back and they're not going to like it. So I really love the build here. Issue 5 was good too, but it was more of an action-heavy issue, and I actually thought this one was the most effective for me in this role. So just continuing to enjoy Aquaman as one of the best books of the Rebirth Initiative.
Was Aquaman 5 the one where Mira punches Superman in the face?
No, that's Aquaman 6. I haven't gotten there yet. Uh-huh. I just ended 5 is the one where Superman shows up at the end and confronts them, so...
Hmm. Interesting. Well, I'm glad to hear you're enjoying it. I had little doubt that you would once you finally got there. It's just taking you some time to catch up. But you know, you mentioned enjoying a book that didn't have a lot of action in it. My number three is a book that had a lot of action in it, and all I can say is thank God, finally. This may come as a bit of a surprise to some people, but my number three book of the last 2 weeks is Civil War II, number 5. This is a book, a title, an event that has been relatively eventless because outside of the Hulk dying, or Bruce Banner dying, excuse me, not much has gone on. We've had a free Comic Book Day prologue, a zero issue, and now here in finally what is essentially the 7th issue of this title, there is actually a battle, what appears to be an actual legitimate civil war between heroes.
There's actually an engagement within a civil war?
Yes, that is what it appears to be. Now, granted, the reasoning for these heroes fighting is still a bit flimsy, but the fight scenes are really good, the art is really good, and this provides a new aspect to the conflict at the end of the book where, and I can't really discuss this book without getting to some mild spoilers, so we're going to spoil this here, and you're not going to read it anyway, so you don't care. They reveal at the end of the book that the Inhuman Ulysses, who has been showing the various characters of the Marvel Universe's glimpse of what Carol Danvers believes to be the future and Tony Stark believes to be but one of many possible futures, he shows a vision of Miles Morales murdering Steve Rogers. Now, this leads to an increased debate between all the heroes over whether a 14 to 15-year-old kid, who to this point has proven himself to be nothing but an asset to the superhero community and nothing but trustworthy, earning the endorsements of characters such as Sam Wilson, Steve Rogers himself, Peter Parker, a kid who has literally been beyond reproach to this point, he is actually... Captain Marvel attempts to take him into custody based on this vision. And so that kind of sets up the new divide. You see the younger heroes start to question their belief in each side. So it's a very intriguing ending, especially because, as we've discussed in the past on the podcast, one of the things going on in the Marvel Universe right now that we don't... The knowledge that we have that the characters do not have is that Steve Rogers currently is actually an agent of Hydra. So my take on this is it's very possible that Miles Morales in this possible future could be acting out of a heroic nature and accidentally taking it too far. And people are just assuming that he is murdering, you know, the benevolent Steve Rogers that we have come to know and love. So I like the new take on this. I like
or
the twist on it.
There's a chance that it's all bullshit.
That's the chance that it's all bullshit as well. I will say that I did read, while I didn't read the actual issue, apparently they did reveal, if you recall, Greg, one of my favorite subplots of the original Civil War was the implication, if not outright stating, that the conflict may or may not have been orchestrated by Tony Stark from the beginning for financial gain. I think you remember that subplot. Mm-hmm. It was hinted around at.
Sure.
In a recent issue of Captain America Steve Rogers, they hint around at perhaps Steve has actually been orchestrating this entire conflict from the get-go. They find out that he was the one who helped Bruce to develop the Hulk-killing arrow, and he was the one who encouraged Bruce Banner to write the letter to Hawkeye about taking him out if he ever got out of control again. And you see that Bruce is starting to play these, or excuse me, Steve is starting to play these two sides against one another for, you know, some eventual gain of his own. So I am much more intrigued in the ending of this event than I was previously. I'll say that much.
Interesting. My number two book of the time frame is Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, and I'm going all the way back to number two. This is the only one I've read so far of that period, so I'm way behind on this. But Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number two, just fantastic. Just it made it feel as if the last 3 years never happened in the Green Lantern universe. It's just a tremendous resetting of the status quo. You get Guy Gardner. He only gets about two or three lines, but they're phenomenal Guy Gardner lines. John Stewart being the team leader that he was always meant to be. Kilowog being Kilowog. Hal being Hal and flying into the face of danger and kicking the asses of two Sinestro Corps members. Sinestro being awesome and having this tremendous, tremendous banter with his daughter. Just a terrific return to form for the Green Lantern franchise. Can't say enough. And like we've talked about before, like Nick has said over the last, gosh, month, 2 months, a shockingly fast turnaround for Robert Venditti, for a guy who it seemed like for a long time didn't understand the Green Lantern mythos. Now it looks like he's...
Well, more specifically, it seemed like he just didn't understand Hal Jordan.
Yeah.
You know?
And now it feels like he's just turned it all on its head, and he totally gets it. So he's writing a relatable, believable Hal Jordan along with the rest of the core. It doesn't feel to me like anyone's getting short shrift on time, which was a concern in this book. It just feels like a good Green Lantern book, and Lord knows it's been long enough since we've had one. So just... really good stuff. I'm really excited to see 3, 4, 5, and so on. So, good job, Venditti, and Sandoval and the whole crew there at the Green Lantern Corps.
Well, not to tell tales out of school, but if you enjoyed the Guy Gardner stuff in issue 2, just wait. The best is yet to come, my friend.
Mm.
So, moving on to my number 2 of the last 2 weeks, I have got Trinity number 1. You mentioned a few minutes ago giving Aquaman props for being a comic that is largely dialogue-driven, mm-hmm. and it's something that you and I tend to enjoy more than most. I have a feeling when you get to Trinity number 1, you will enjoy it for much the same reason. It is essentially an extended conversation between not just Bruce, Clark, and Diana, but also Lois. And you start to see how these four characters are going to interact with each other and what the new status quo is going to be going forward and how they're going to form new bonds with a Superman who is not, not the Superman that this Bruce and this Diana know and remember. So, love this book, love the art, love the emotion in it. Very intrigued to see where they go with it, you know, from here. Who they choose as a physical threat, or if they even have a physical threat for a couple issues. I think there's a lot of relationship building to be done here, so I'm intrigued to see if they might slow play this one a lot. And I gotta say, fantastic job by Francis Manapul on the writing and the art this time. Never knew much about him as a writer, knew he was a great artist, but he knocked this one out of the park, especially in terms of the dialogue, particularly on the scenes with Lois and Diana interacting.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about this book from you and from Russell and from some other people as well that has got me sufficiently intrigued. I have to admit, when this book was first announced, I wasn't that interested in it. And, you know, because I figured, you know, we've got Justice League books. What do we really need a Trinity book for? But everything I've read about it has made it sound different and intriguing and valuable, especially in a marketplace that is lacking a good Justice League book. So, yeah, this sounds really good. So I'm looking forward to it.
Spoiler alert, Greg.
Oh, well, maybe not. Who knows? That's great. And I'm going to move on to my number one, which is another Rebirth book that has been highly acclaimed and for good reason. Wonder Woman number 4, which is part 2 of the Year One story by Greg Rucka and Nicola Scott. And this was an easy slam dunk for number 1 for me. This was a comic book that probably one of my favorites of the year so far. I was such a big fan of this. This is retelling a key part of Diana's origin on Themyscira. Steve has been captured, and or not captured, but he's been rescued, and they're debating what to do with him. Basically, all the Amazonians are debating this, and Hippolyta has to make the ultimate decision of what to do with him and how to send him back to man's world. And it's an exciting, thrilling, well-drawn, ultimately heartbreaking issue, because Diana has to make that decision at the end to leave the Mascara, to go with Steve, and she's being told that she can never come back again, that if she leaves the island, that's it. She can never come back again. And Hippolyta is, you know, beholden to this rule that if Diana leaves, she can never come back again. And Hippolyta herself is heartbroken. And it flashed me back to a great Justice League episode that touched on this same kind of concept. And just the art from Nicola Scott just portrayed the emotions so well of the mother and daughter relationship here. Really touched me, really got through to me, and can't say enough about how effective this was. I've not had a chance to read a lot of Wonder Woman stories, but of all the Wonder Woman stories I've read, this current one is the one that is hooking me the most. And it, much like George Perez did in the late 80s, it feels like Greg Rucka is truly redefining Wonder Woman for a new generation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've very much enjoyed this Wonder Woman series. You know, I think you're a little bit higher on the Year One storyline than I am. I have preferred the Lies. And with that in mind, my number one book of the two-week period is Wonder Woman number 7. This is the not the wrap-up to the Lies, necessarily, but it is a little bit of a wrap-up to the Cheetah Urs-Kartaga storyline, where Wonder Woman is, you know, in the jungle, builds to a pretty emotional confrontation between Diana, Urs-Kartaga, and the Cheetah, including a shocking status quo shift for the Cheetah that I did not see coming going into this issue. I thought they knocked it out of the park on this one. Liam Sharp continues, to me anyway, to be the breakout star of Rebirth. His art is just amazing. I love everything about the way he draws Diana and her supporting cast, and very intrigued to see where they go going forward. I know that they're doing an all Cheetah issue at some point that's going to kind of tell more of her backstory, and I can't wait for that. That's been a shock to me, is how much I have enjoyed that character, who in the past has kind of been cheesy and one note in my opinion. So almost positioning the Cheetah as the Sinestro of this run, where they're, you know, reclaiming the character in such a grand way. So Wonder Woman number 7 takes home my number one spot.
Pretty telling about how great this series is that it was that two separate issues were our top books of a given time period. So highly impressive run right now by Rucka and company on this book. So moving on to the bad side. Our worst book of the week, our bottom book of the week. And we've talked many times about how it's very hard sometimes to pick a worst book of the week, because, you know, usually if we're pulling a book, it means that we like it. You know, that usually means, because we're not in the position to spend money on books that we don't like. So typically, and most of the books we get, they might have a down issue here or there, but pretty consistent. So a lot of times our bottom book is just a good book that wasn't quite as good as the rest that we read. Well, I've read a lot of books, and this was not a difficult decision this time around. Again, for the second straight podcast, I have to go with a Justice League issue, and this one is Justice League number 3.
How many Justice League issues did you read, out of curiosity?
Of this time period, just this one. Overall, I've read all three of them, though. But this was by Brian Hitch and Tony Daniel. And In fairness, I thought this was actually a little bit better than 2, which was my bottom book of the last podcast that we did with this segment on it. But, you know, it's just not interesting. I don't know how else to put it. It's not – I can't in good conscience say that this is a bad comic book, because this issue in particular had some good moments. Like, the best moment was Superman's son, John, offering Batman a cookie. I thought that actually made me chuckle, because the idea of Batman being offered a cookie and how he would respond to that situation. But too many of the characters are just written to talk exactly the same way. It's like a boring version of Silver Age Justice League, where they all have interchangeable voices. Yep. And, you know, I'm just expecting them to put their fists on their hips and laugh on occasion, you know? But it's a boring, like, at least in the Silver Age Justice League comics, stuff was happening. In this, it's a lot of nameless, faceless alien creatures bizarrely joining together like Captain Planet, and again, not doing anything, just literally walking, it appears. And it's really a waste of Tony Daniels' talent, who's a really good artist. His art in this issue was not up to his usual standards, looked a little rushed. It's not bad, obviously. It's just not – I don't think it's up to par with what I've seen from him in the past.
No.
And it's just, you know, like you said, it's boring. It's just a boring comic book. And
you won't call Justice League bad right now. I'll call it bad, because my bottom book of the week is Justice League number 5. The series is bad, and I'm done with it. I'm finally – I know I've said that before, but I gave it till the end of the storyline. I'm not picking this up anymore. It is bad. It's poorly written. The art is sloppy at times. There is just nothing compelling enough to keep this book on my pull list.
Yeah, no, I haven't gotten that far, because I stopped pulling it – well, I was supposed to have stopped pulling it after 2, but another issue landed in my pull list somehow, so I read it. But it's, you know, the ones that I've read, it's just so boring. There's nothing – how can you write a boring Justice League book? Even the bad Justice League stories I've read, I wouldn't say boring. I'll just say they were bad. This is just boring.
Right.
Nothing happens. So just, you know, again, both Nick and I gave Justice League a chance. We gave it a try, and it didn't make the cut. Sorry, Justice League. You're out. Now,
indeed.
Quick hits.
Oh.
Got a lot of these. I don't know about...
Yeah.
I got a lot of these.
I got... Let's see here.
Why don't you go first on the quick hits? Because I got one in particular that I want to pull a quote from. So.
And you want me to do all mine right back to back?
Or we can trade back and forth.
Let's trade back and forth. I'll go first. Batman Beyond Rebirth number 1. Like some of the other Rebirth titles that we've talked about, nothing wrong with it. Fine book, decent writing, decent art, but decent doesn't earn a spot on my pull list these days.
Which book was this again?
Batman Beyond Rebirth number 1. Mm-hmm. This also, one of the things I didn't like about it, it's a pretty good jumping on point, but it expected you to have a knowledge of what had happened after the Futures End event, when Tim Drake took over the role of Batman Beyond from Terry McGinnis, and I was confused by references to that time period. So, decent book, but will not be on my pull list going forward.
Yeah. I haven't had a chance to try that out yet, because I just don't have the money, and I've not really ever been a huge Batman Beyond fan. But still struggling, I should say, to find it.
But it's Dan Jurgens, Greg, and as you've said before, you know, it's more important to know about the creators than it is the characters.
It is, absolutely. And I would be willing to try this out solely because he was writing it. If anyone else was writing Batman Beyond, I probably wouldn't be interested in it at all. Yeah, I'm having trouble finding what I'm looking for, so I'm going to move on to a different book for a quick hit. And I'm going to do 2 at a time on some of these, because I've read them back to back. This would be a book that is no longer on my pull list, as we talked about before, but I had 2 in the queue that I had bought. Batman 4 and 5, continuing the Gotham and Gotham Girl story. Again, pretty good comics. The art is tremendous. David Finch, to me, is the best part of this run. No knock on Tom King, but it's just not blowing me away. It's good. It's not great. I find Alfred to be the best written of the characters. He's really good. I think that he writes Bruce well, too. But the overall story, just it's been okay. I mean, a little bit better than okay, but not great. Not to the standards of like Scott Snyder Batman or something that I just had to read every month. So I don't really regret dropping it off my list. Not to say that I won't read the trade, because I probably will read the next trade. But I thought 5 in particular had some good moments in it, but I wasn't nuts about having Gotham, who I don't think is the greatest character in the world, literally destroy the Justice League in a fight. That was kind of a cheap tactic to build up a character, I thought. So Batman 4 and 5, pretty good, but not great.
Fair enough. I've got Blue Beetle #1, and I'll say the same thing that you just did. Pretty good, not great. Kind of a step down from the Rebirth issue, I thought. Focuses a lot more on Jaime and less on Ted Kord, and I don't have anything against Jaime. I think he's a fine character, but I was buying this book for Ted Kord, and I wanted a little bit more Kord in my life. So I don't know that this one's going to last on my pull list. I may give it one more issue, but again, nothing wrong with it. It's just it's so tough right now to find room for everything I want to buy, especially with some of the Marvel books that are getting ready to launch here that I absolutely have to buy. So, yeah, fine book. The Scott Collins art, I'm still not – I'm kind of iffy on it, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. Probably give it, like I said, one more issue.
Understandable. I have actually – pardon me. I have not purchased the Rebirth issue because for reasons that I won't get into here yet. I'm still trying to get a copy of that. I do have #1 sitting in my queue of books to read, so I'll get to that eventually. But the next book I want to talk about on my quick hits would be Green Lanterns 4 and 5. Continues to be an entertaining book. Jessica Cruz is tremendous, and they're starting to get a handle on Simon now, I feel. And they are the strength of the book. The overall plot, the Red Lantern stuff, could not be less interested in it. But the Simon and Jessica dynamic, could not be more interested in it. Sam Humphries does a great job of writing their teamwork, writing their kind of reluctant alliance, and you really get a sense that they're actually starting to get forged into a friendship through their experience together. So 4 and 5, good books. I thought 5 was better than 4, and just continues to be a fairly well-written, well-drawn Green Lantern comic. Really excited about where it goes heading forward, because I think this partnership has a lot of potential. So that's all I'll say about that.
All right. I'll hit you with 3 books real quick. Those being Batman 7, Nightwing 5, and Detective Comics 941, the first 3 parts of the Night of the Monster Men storyline. Exceedingly average comics, exceedingly average concepts, exceedingly average execution. Ready for this story to be over.
Well, that very succinctly sums it up.
It's called Quick Hits for a
That's
reason,
right.
Greg.
Aquaman #5, another tremendous issue of Aquaman. Good action, great art, great writing. Mira continues to be the star. Just tremendous. Can't say enough.
Action Comics 964, the second part of the Superman meet Clark Kent storyline. All I'll say here is I hope that the explanation given for the Clark Kent character is not what they are trying to sell you on initially. I hope that it is a red herring, because if so, it is one of the most convenient retcons of all the times.
All right. Moving along, this is the book that I was referring to earlier that almost made my #3 on my best books of this time period. Deathstroke #1. By Christopher Priest and this artist whose name I can't pronounce, so I'm not even going to try. This was the most unexpectedly funny book of Rebirth, because the dynamic between Slade Wilson and William Wintergreen is amazing. it's a kind of dynamic I never knew could exist. So it's just tremendous. And I'll leave the listeners and you, Nick, with one snippet of dialogue from Mr. Wintergreen. Adeline, velociraptorous as always, your bosom is magnificent.
Interesting. I got one for you. Here's a book I know you're going to love whenever you get to it. Superman number 7. Pete Tomasi, Patrick Gleason continue to execute very well. And this is essentially a night out for the Kent family, or excuse me, the Smith family, I should say. And that's pretty much the entire book. So it's one of those that, once again, is very dialogue driven and has some great Superman moments. So I think you'll enjoy this one when the time comes.
Very fortuitous that you had mentioned that book. I'm looking forward to it because I read Superman issues, and let me make sure I get these issues correct here. 4 and 5 of Superman, which is kind of wrapping up the Eradicator story, or not really wrapping it up, but coming close to wrapping up the Eradicator story. Really good stuff. I mean, everybody that listens to this show knows that Jonathan Kent / Jonathan Smith is my favorite new character in the DC universe in quite a long time, and the Superman books continue to rock my world, both of them, and this one in particular is the family Superman book that you never knew you wanted, but you always did. So just tremendous month in and month out, week in and week out, I should say, and I'm really excited to see how they build on this family dynamic.
Absolutely. I've got the Mighty Thor number 11. Continue to enjoy this book. I still don't think it's up to the heights of Thor God of Thunder or even the Thor series that preceded this. But, you know, still pretty good. Still enjoying this overall. They introduce a new power for Mjolnir that is somewhat unique. Interested to see if that's all it appears to be, or if it might be, you know, a little bit of misdirection on that one. So enjoy the Mighty Thor. Looking forward to the next storyline, though, which is supposed to be the long rumored War of the Realms that they've been building to pretty much since God Bomb wrapped up all the way back then. They started putting the pieces of the story together. So very much looking forward to that in the next couple months.
It just occurred to me that Aquaman should do a big story arc called Cod Bomb. That's just me. That's just one man's opinion. Okay, my last quick hits will be Green Arrow 4 and 5. Read these as well. Good. Entertaining. I have to say, I don't think that I was probably as high on these as a lot of people were. Again, very good. Very, very good. But I don't know. It's just it feels to me like this story lost a little bit of steam along the way, and I don't know why I feel that way. But this was the arc involving what are they called? The Inferno and the character of Dante, or Disco Freddy, as Jennifer Smith calls him. And it was good, but I thought issue 4 in particular felt like a filler issue that was there to fill space. Issue 5 I thought was a lot better. It was really good. And wrapped it up in a nice, succinct way. But I don't know. Maybe it was the art. I don't know what it was. Something was holding me back from buying into the last few issues of this story the way that I did the first few. So I know that was a little bit longer than quick hits, but I wanted to elaborate a little bit. So
that's fine. Along the same lines, Green Arrow number 7. I think the two-part Sins of the Mother storyline has been the two weakest issues of this series thus far. Ben Percy has a very good handle on Amico. I don't think he has a very good handle on Shadow, personally. So a little disappointed with his handling of that character, but very, very intrigued by the Island of Scars storyline that's going to start up in issue 8.
Yeah, one thing that I want to say about Percy's Green Arrow, it's a totally different version of Diggle than what you get on the show, but I really like the dynamic between Oliver and Diggle. I thought that was really fun.
Yes, it's been good.
So that wraps up reading and watching. Unless you have any other.
My God! Yeah, I've got several. I thought you had some more. All right,
I've been doubling up, so I'm all done.
Oh, okay, here we go. Green Lantern's number 7. Greg, if you like the Jessica Cruz and Simon Baz dynamic, how about an issue that's almost entirely just them having a conversation?
Yes, right up my alley.
There you go. Star Wars 23, continue to enjoy this book. Jason Aaron writes these characters, honestly, better than George Lucas did at times. You can just hear, you know, the voices in your head, and all the dialogue seems so natural for Han, Luke, and Leia. So, loving the Star Wars series.
Is there any reference to younglings?
No, there's no younglings. You can get those references in the Darth Vader series, which I'll make you read at some point. Teen Titans Rebirth number 1. Really, really enjoyed this. Did not make my top 3, but enjoyed the hell out of it. Especially enjoyed the role that Damian plays in this issue, putting the team together. I think it's pretty funny. I think you'll enjoy it when you finally get around to reading it. Titans number 3. Thought this was the best issue of Titans since the Rebirth. I think it had some great scenes between Wally and Linda, and I think it had some great scenes between the rest of the Titans. Interesting dynamics being developed here. Can't wait to see where they go. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number 5. I told you earlier that you hadn't seen nothing when it came to Guy Gardner. When you get to 5, I think you'll understand what I meant. Just a fantastic, fantastic issue. And finally, the book that came the closest to cracking my top 3, but just couldn't quite make it, Aquaman number 7. Very much enjoyed this book. Sets up a new storyline for Mira and a storyline for Arthur, almost as if they're going to have their own separate storylines running concurrently in this book. So I'm very intrigued by that. So those are my quick hits for the week.
And there you have it, folks. Reading and watching another one in the bucket. This was a longer one than we usually have, a much longer one, but it's been a longer time frame, so that's what you get. Now, when next we talk about this, I probably won't have caught up with all my comics yet because we have to do a long book next week, but I can assure you I will have read enough to do another reading, watching, top 3, bottom 1, quick hits segment. So hope you enjoyed that. And now we move on. Yes, we have even more in this segment, folks, to the rundown, where we talk about the news, the notes, the rumors, the innuendo, the speculation in the comic book industry, all the hot news, and we give you our hot takes on the hot news. So, folks, we've got a bunch of things to talk to you about today. We're going to start it out with a little project that I really wanted to talk about, which is this, and I apologize if I'm not pronouncing this character's name correctly, the Commandy Challenge from DC Comics. What this is it's essentially a reboot of the 1985-86 Maxi Series DC Challenge, which I had never heard of until this. But apparently, what that did was it was a round-robin title that featured work from creators in a shared sandbox who didn't have the ability to talk to each other about what they were doing, and they were all assigned different parts of it and just told, do what you want, basically. Really cool, I think, concept. And the new one is set in the world of Jack Kirby's Commandy, with 12 art teams and 12 writers pairing up to do a year-long project within the Commandy map that was created by Kirby. So they finally announced the list of creative teams, and there are some big names attached to this, some really cool teams that will all be writing things about different parts of this this world, this, you know, Earth AD world that Jack Kirby created. So you're going to have a prologue that will be written by Dan DiDio with art by Keith Giffen, and you're going to have a finale that will feature an epilogue by Len Wein, legendary comic book creator, and one of the biggest pieces of news that's kind of gotten buried in this, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez is drawing this epilogue. And for those that don't know, Garcia Lopez was arguably DC's preeminent artist of the late 70s and early 80s, sort of the end of the pre-crisis era. He was, in many people's minds, the definitive artist on that era of Justice League and Superman and a lot of other characters. So really, really cool to get him on this project. And real quick, I'm going to read through these creative teams. And issue number 1 by Dan Abnett and Dale Eaglesham. Issue number 2 by Peter J. Tomasi and Neil Adams. Issue number 3 by Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor. Issue 4 by James Tynion and Carlos DeAnda. Issue 5 by Bill Willingham and Ivan Rice. Issue 6 by Steve Orlando and Philip Tan. 7 by Marguerite Bennett and Dan Jurgens. 8 by Keith Giffen and Steve Rude. 9 by Tom King and Kevin Eastman. 10 by Greg Pak and Joe Prado. 11 by Rob Williams and Walter Simonson. And 12 by Gail Simone and Ryan Sook. Nick, do you have any reaction to this project or to these creative teams?
I know nothing about Commandy and don't really have an overwhelming interest in learning more about Commandy, but I will say it's kind of cool to see particularly the artists. Some of the artists they have, I'll just call out a few that drew my attention. Neil Adams, say what you will about the guy's writing, but if it's going to be Pete Tomasi and Neil Adams drawing, Neil can still go, man. That Coming of the Superman book, while I only read a little bit of it, and it wasn't very good from a writing standpoint, the art still looks great. So looking forward to that. Walt Simonson, he's probably slipped a little bit more than a lot of his contemporaries when it comes to art, but still, it's freaking Walt Simonson. So, and then the one that kind of stood out to me the most, Kevin Eastman, of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fame. To my knowledge, is this not his first DC project?
Yep,
that's pretty cool. So those are the ones that that caught my eye. It's been interesting. I'm certainly intrigued by the concept, even if I think it would lend itself to a bit of a disjointed narrative.
Yeah, I can see that. It's definitely a risk for sure, but one that should be cool. I'm especially interested. They don't have it listed here, Nick, but did you hear about the creative team on issue 13? They're actually doing an issue 13 with the creative team of Jim Barnett and Stu Hart.
Oh, I wonder what that would sound like.
Yeah.
What the creative meetings would sound like.
I got an idea, my boy. I got an idea. Put him in the hammerlock.
Thanks, Stu. That's real nice, Stu. We're doing a news announcement, for God's sake.
Hey, Jim, Mr. Barnett, can you tell me what is the tagline for Commandy? What's his nickname?
The last my boy on Earth.
There you go.
Very good. And that's the end of that announcement. Nick, do you want to hit him with the next one? The next news item?
I'll do it. Mainly because I'm not sure which one we were going to do next. So I'm gonna throw that one over to you.
It doesn't matter. We can do any of these. We've got so many. I mean, gosh. We're going to go with a Marvel story here that is kind of weird. Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. Some might say it's somewhat unique, folks.
Somewhat unique indeed.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so the story we're talking about is that, I don't know how many people are aware of this, we have talked about it on the podcast, but there is a new Venom series getting ready to launch, a Venom number one that's supposed to come out either in October or November. I'm a little fuzzy on the actual release date. November 23rd, apparently. Anyway, as Marvel often does with a lot of its number one issues and various other issues, they're putting out a litany of variant covers for this. And so they had a top secret variant listed on the solicits for a long time. And, you know, during the last 2 weeks, it was eventually revealed that the artist for that variant cover was going to be Venom creator Todd McFarlane, which was really cool news if all you did was read the headline.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a hell of a catch. Greg, tell them what the catch is.
Well, the catch is that instead of this being a huge story about Todd McFarlane working for Marvel again for the first time in forever, instead, the cover is actually just a recolored panel from an interior that he drew back when he was the artist on Amazing Spider-Man back in the 80s.
Back in the 1988 issue, Spider-Man 299.
The first appearance of Eddie Brock as Venom. They took that image from that panel, and they basically got Richard Eisenhoff to recolor it, and they're using that as the cover, which is not unprecedented. Apparently they did it with a Walt Simonson cover on The Mighty Thor and with a George Perez variant on Patsy Walker, a.k.a. Hellcat. But it doesn't change the fact that it's weird and kind of gimmicky and rip-off-y, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm sure Todd will get paid for it, right?
Certainly,
I would have to assume so.
It's interesting because here's what he wrote about it. He was texted by Newsarama, actually, and texted back. Someone from someone from Marvel sent me an email to give me a heads up a couple of days ago about it. Seems a bit odd to me, as you would expect original artwork on a cover, especially with such an anticipated book. But they get to make whatever decisions they deem fit. Though I have to tell you, I am a much better artist today than that version of Todd they are using. And I could draw one Wicked Venom that would be way cooler than that. But as a direct competitor to Marvel, it can't happen. I'm also flattered that they still want me to work for them 20 years later. So, nice little shot there at the end, I guess. But he seemed as caught off guard by it as the fans were. So, just whatever you think of Todd McFarlane, whatever you think of his art, whatever you think of his personality, whatever, it seems like a weird practice. I'm not even saying it's a bad practice. I'm just saying it's a weird practice. It's kind of strange. Like he said, if you're launching a new book, get some new artwork for it, or even do a tribute to it. Maybe get a modern artist to do a tribute to McFarlane's Venom, but just right. Taking an interior panel and making it a cover, that's not a comic book cover.
I agree. I mean, I really don't know what else to say about it. I wish like hell there was a way for us to get a modern McFarlane Venom cover. Not that I'm going to read the book. It's just it would be a hell of a cool image. You know, nobody, in my opinion, in the character's entire history, has ever drawn Venom as well as Todd McFarlane.
So completely.
It'd be great to see that, you know, what a modern-day version of that would look like. Because, I mean, that's one thing you've always kind of wondered is, with McFarlane's long exile from, you know, a lot of mainstream comics, it is kind of tempting to think about what his more modern takes on some of the classic characters would be, so...
Yeah, and speaking of Todd McFarlane, that moves us into our next story. One of Todd McFarlane's most famous and enduring stories that wasn't from Marvel or Image, one of his most prominent DC, probably his most prominent DC work, I would say, was...
Yeah, I didn't do a ton of DC work, but I think this
the late 1980s, I believe 1988, crossover event, Invasion, which... is a great story if you haven't read it. It holds up very well to this day. It's one of the best DC crossovers, in my opinion. And he was the primary artist for this. Well, the main villains of that, the primary antagonist, was an alien race that Nick and I are probably most familiar with through their appearances in Green Lantern, the Dominators. And yep. McFarlane kind of redesigned these characters that were started in the 60s as Legion villains. Created by Jim Shooter, oddly enough, when he was the writer of Legion. So these Dominators are going to be the primary antagonists in the much-anticipated fall crossover between all the CW-DC shows.
Yes, the four-night DC-CW crossover. Essentially a four-hour-long miniseries that week, which I can't wait for.
Supergirl, The Flash, Arrow, and Legends of Tomorrow are going to do this crossover, and apparently the Dominators are going to be the bad guys. And it seems like it, and according to Mark Guggenheim, who produces Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow, they are basing the story off of Invasion. So, really ambitious, would you say? But
I would think the budget for this is, I mean, if they're going to do a full-out alien invasion angle across four shows, that's going to be a massive undertaking. Four shows that, you know, let's be honest, we love the CW shows, and we are quick to call them out for, or to praise them for accomplishing a hell of a lot of special effects on what is a limited budget. But at times, I think you would admit, Greg, the special effects can dip considerably, mm-hmm. and I am hoping that they have got the budget they need to pull this one off.
Yeah, a good example of that would be the episode of Supergirl that had Livewire on it. Not Livewire. They had a team up with Livewire and Silver Banshee. It was a good example of when the special effects don't necessarily match up to what they want them to be. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful because it's bold, but I've got faith in them to pull it off. And the one show that I wonder how it's going to fit in this is Arrow, because it's I know they've done magic and they've done all kinds of supernatural stuff. It's kind of hard to see that kind of gritty tone they're going with for Arrow this season fitting in with an alien invasion story. But hey, maybe they could do it like They Live, you know? Who knows?
Yeah, there's any number of directions it could go. I think the special effects that stood out to me the worst last season was probably the effects on Giant Atom whenever Ray went big in that one episode. Those kind of stood out to me. Very, very Mighty Morphin Power Rangers-esque in my opinion.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, quite frankly. You know, the Power Rangers are, quite frankly, fine individuals.
They're fine, yeah. They're going to get a gritty urban big screen reboot.
Everything needs a gritty urban reboot, I think. Everything.
Especially yep. Commando.
Oh, God. Oh, Nick. I could do a whole podcast on why that's a horrible idea. Moving along, we've got one more news item for you this week.
We've got two more.
Do we? Well, tell us.
We do.
The one that I was referring to. I'll go ahead and tell them the first one, then you tell them the second one. The first one is the members and one of the creators of the Justice League of America book that is coming out in the spring, I believe, been announced. February, so still in the winter technically, but yeah. So we've got the announcement of four members of this group that will be a part of the team.
With more to come. Yes. This is not the entire roster.
So far they have announced Vixen, which makes sense because she's going to be on Legends of Tomorrow. The Ray, which was an interesting choice because I have just recently read the early 90s relaunch of The Ray, who was a Golden Age character. They reinvented him for the 90s, and that's kind of the version that most people know now. So,
But I think they did a version in Multiversity that I believe will be used here. And the reason why I believe that is Steve Orlando, who's one of the creators, has said on Twitter that his goal with this book is to create a league that more represents modern-day America, especially when it comes to things such as diversity. So look at the roster we have thus far. You've got Vixen, who is, you know, an African-American. You've got the Ryan Choi Adam, an Asian-American. You've got Killer Frost, who is a woman. And then, of course, the Ray. My understanding is that the multiversity version of the character was a gay character.
Yes.
So I believe that is the version they're going to go with.
I think that's what they're going to go with as well. And, yeah, so I didn't get to them yet. But, yeah, the Adam is also a part of this, Ryan Choi. And Killer Frost is also a part of this. So that is good. And as far as the creative team goes, we've got Steve Orlando, I believe. Is he writing it?
Yep, Steve Orlando is
writing it. And Ivan Rice is going to be the artist on it.
Be one of the artists.
It's a twice-monthly book.
Because the belief is that this will, be a twice-monthly book, so Ivan Rice will be on for a time and then rotate off for a time or however you want to handle it. But he hadn't really been doing a ton. He was one of the rotating artists on Superman. I don't know if he will continue to, you know, have any art duties for that, but going forward, or if this is going to be his full-time gig now. But very, very glad to see him getting a high-profile assignment.
It's one of the best.
And interested to see how this team, what the storyline reasoning is for this team coming together out of the Justice League versus Suicide Squad.
Particularly Killer Frost. That'll be interesting to see what they do with her.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so with that being said, let's move on to our last rundown topic. I know this is one that caught your eye. And that's the news that, you know, you and I have talked about on this podcast, DC's various imprints, whether it be Vertigo and some of the issues they're having there, or if it is the new Young Animal imprint from Gerard Way. Well, news broke very recently that Warren Ellis has been being tagged to, or being tapped, I should say, to relaunch another DC Comics line, and he will be bringing back the Wildstorm universe, or the Wildstorm line of comics. Greg, tell us some more about that.
Yeah, for those that don't know, Wildstorm is an imprint that originated in Image Comics. It's really interesting. It started as an Image Comics imprint in the early 90s by Jim Lee, who was one of the founders of Image. And, you know, this was the imprint that had a lot of the famous and popular comics properties in the 90s. Wildcats, Gen 13, Wetworks, The Authority, Stormwatch, God, what else? Planetary. So all of these great, you know, classic characters. And Warren Ellis wrote a lot of these. He wrote some Wildcats. He was the writer of The Authority. He wrote Planetary. You know, he was one of the guiding voices of this Wildstorm universe. The imprint went from Image. It then became its own thing when Lee was the publisher. And then it moved over to Marvel. to DC, I should say. He sold it to DC in 99, and it became a DC imprint for years until they kind of merged them with the New 52. And, you know, the interesting thing here is Jim Lee has gone back to Warren Ellis and selected him to be the guiding voice in the same way that Gerard Way is for the Young Animal imprint of the New Wildstorm imprint. Now, what's interesting about this as well, as Nick pointed out earlier, in off air, as we'll say, is that the New 52 bringing characters like Grifter and Midnighter and Apollo into continuity kind of complicates things here, because presumably if it's an imprint, you assume that it's its own universe separate from the primary DC universe. But if you're taking some pretty major players off the board if we're to believe that the New 52 continuity is still intact. Now, we don't know the details yet. The only details we really know are that the primary book that's going to launch this imprint will be called The Wildstorm, and will be written by Warren Ellis, and it will be kind of setting the new status quo of this universe. Kind of like George Perez and Marv Wolfman's History of the DC Universe in the 80s. It'll be kind of setting the template for how things are for the Wildstorm universe going forward. We should find out more later this month, actually, at the Meet the Publishers panel at New York Comic Con. But right now, all we know basically is that the imprint is coming back, that it's going to give us new takes on characters like Grifter and like Zealot, and that right now they've got three ongoing series planned out of it, in addition to the main series, The Wildstorm, mentioned earlier, Michael Cray, Wildcats, and Zealot. I know nothing about Michael Cray. I know Zealot, and I know Wildcats. So, should be interesting.
Michael Cray is the alter ego of Deathblow, and that's all I know about him.
Well, this is a pretty cool thing. What do you make of this story, Nick?
Not much, because I... not much, you know.
Joe's doll be Joe, and...
Then they fight. No, I don't... It's very interesting. Warren Ellis is a great creator. I love pretty much everything I've ever read from him. I just don't know a lot about the Wildstorm universe. I do see some names that pop out here to me. I did see that Jenny Sparks will be back in the Wildstorm title, so at least a character that I have a minor understanding of. Interested to see they've already got four titles announced, no creative teams yet, but we'll see how it goes. I think it's interesting to see Warren Ellis making a more long-term commitment to working for one of the big two, something he has been reticent to do in recent years, preferring to come on for limited runs. So, interested to see how long this lasts and what the future of this line will be and how well.
And it actually is pretty timely for us, given that we just recently reviewed The Authority for the first time, and we have expressed interest in learning more about the Wildstorm universe. So maybe we should explore that. If some enterprising souls out there want to ship us a few Wildstorm books from the 90s and early 2000s, we wouldn't be opposed to it.
And if anybody wants to buy any Image comics from the early 90s,
for God's sake, let it go. People aren't—you're not going to get a buyer, for God's sake.
Hey, listen, I've got stuff like the Max. Isn't that his name?
Max,
the Max,
yeah. TJ Max, okay. Yep.
Yeah. TJ Perkins.
Just don't call him Technical Lightning, and you're good. With all that being said, folks, we've gone way over our normal time limit here for our opening bit. But we hope you've enjoyed our comics chatter. When we come back from the other side, we're going to get to the real reason you guys are here. Walking Dead month. Our look back at the premiere episode, Days Gone By, of The Walking Dead. So be sure to stick through the commercials and come back on the other side, and we will start the show then.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's Past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners, as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Team's Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
It's a rare condition this day and age to read any good news on the newspaper page. And love and tradition of the grand design, some people say, is even harder to find. Well, then there must be some magic clue inside these gentle walls, 'cause all I see is a tower of dreams.
Welcome back, loyal listeners. We hope you enjoyed the awesome song that plays while Kevin Kelly talks during the commercials. Big fan of that song, as Nick can attest.
And a little bit of that Family Matters theme. Hope you enjoy that as well.
Yes, Dave.
And when you do, just think to yourself of Reginald Vell Johnson walking down the stairs with a smug smile on his face, crossing his arms and nodding at the camera.
And while you're at it, play this new little game with your friends. You've heard, perhaps, of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. Well, try 6 degrees of Reginald Vell Johnson.
Ooh, interesting. Interesting.
I can tell you from experience, it is a game that is delightful.
Andrew Lincoln.
Oh, Lord, you're putting me on the spot here. Andrew Lincoln was in
Love Actually with Liam Neeson.
Yes, who was in
was in Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, with Samuel L. Jackson, who was in
Die Hard with Bruce Willis,
who was in Die Hard with Reginald Vell Johnson.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's how you do that.
So that's just, you play, you know, you might play differently at home, but
You get the idea. Exactly. You can, if you try hard enough, you can link Reginald Vell Johnson back to the golden age of Hollywood. It's been done.
It's true. You can.
So anyway, with all that said, we are here to review the pilot episode of The Walking Dead, the episode titled Days Gone By. And this is a, you know, this was the big launch for AMC. It was a 6-episode order of this series, and they could not have possibly anticipated what they were getting into. I don't think any of us at the time, I think we got a feeling that this was going to be a hit. I don't think any of us at the time realized the hit that this was going to be, the hit that it was going to be for the comic book industry as a whole.
I mean, there's no way. I mean, you can't even think that AMC knew. I mean, like you said, because they only ordered 6 episodes at first. This was far from a sure thing. I mean, this was, there was the distinct possibility this might just be a six episode, you know, one-off. And nobody really knew what to expect. And I got to be honest, when they first announced it, I didn't even know what the Walking Dead comic was. At that point, it was so far off my radar that, you know, I had heard of it,
but I had never read it. So, right. I can't remember if I actually got the trade after this was announced and read the first trade. I can't remember. But suffice to say, I wasn't a big Walking Dead fan. I wasn't into it. I didn't, you know, I had a basic knowledge of the characters because I think I had read the first trade. But it was something that, you know, it never crossed my mind that this could be a pop culture phenomenon. This was coming on the edge of the vampire fad, I guess you would say, in Hollywood.
Yeah, Twilight was big at the time still. True Blood as well.
The zombie fad had not yet taken off. This was pretty much the launching pad for that of being a... I mean, you'd seen prominent zombie films, certainly, but this is when it became like a major pop culture phenom. So...
Phenom.
Like the Phenom, The Undertaker.
Was Zombieland before or after this?
Zombieland was before this, I think.
Okay, just making sure.
I mean, yeah, I guess she, but I don't know. I feel like Zombieland was great, but it was more of a comedy than it was
launching a
big interest in zombies. You didn't see zombie 4Ks or whatever, or 5Ks or whatever, before The Walking Dead.
That tells you how much you and I know about things like exercise when we call the race a 4K instead of a 5K. Because we're more interested in television. We're far more interested in television resolution than running long distances.
Yeah, I might get a PlayStation 4K before I get a...
before we ever run a 5K.
Yeah, so anyway, so The Walking Dead, we went into it not knowing what we were going to get, and it launched what would become a phenomenon. Well, if any of you have listened off the page before, you know how this works. We like to take whatever we're watching and kind of put it on in the background, watch along with it, and not necessarily offer commentary on what's going on, but have it on just kind of to refresh our memories and to kind of point out things that stand out to us about it. We may not get through this entire episode because it's about an hour long episode, a little bit longer than an hour long episode actually. But we just want to put it on there and kind of talk about the show and what our impressions were. Both of us have watched this in advance of this episode of Hard Traffic Fanboys. And we're going to go back here again and talk about some of the observations we made, how it holds up, what we thought about it at the time, how that's changed, and how we view it through the lens of the show today. So we're both sitting here at the beginning of this episode. I am on Netflix, and I am at 0 minutes and 8 seconds into the episode. I've got it paused. There's a road and a car in the distance, and we're about to hit play. And we are going to hit play in 3, 2, 1, play. And so again, this is the launch of the series. And this is largely based on the first issue of the comic. Now, it does change some things up. It does offer different dialogue, some different character dynamics. But... this here, you see Sheriff Rick Grimes. He's pulling up to a traffic accident. And at the time, you don't realize as a viewer that this is after the zombie apocalypse has already happened. You're like, oh, there's a bunch of traffic on the road. It's turned over. you know, he's driving a sheriff's vehicle, so it looks like he's an active sheriff. So when you're watching this for the first time, you really don't know if, you know, the apocalypse has happened already, if this is just a normal, you know, accident scene. Now you're starting to see more cars turned over, and there's Andrew Lincoln as Rick Grimes surveying the scene, and it's clear that something's up here. Something bad has happened.
Yeah, by this point, when you have the cars that have been just gutted and burned and that kind of thing, I think, and the gas can starts to give away that, you know, we may be dealing with a little bit of a flash forward here, which was an interesting way to open the show. Again, I knew nothing about the comic coming in. I eventually went on to read, you know, some Walking Dead, as we will discuss next week on this here program. But, you know, it's an interesting way to open the show. That's one thing I'll say about this entire pilot is it's very interesting for a show that can at times be gratuitous and over the top in its depiction of gore and violence. I thought this pilot, in hindsight now, shows remarkable
restraint
in my opinion.
I was going to say that.
Which is a good thing. That's not a knock at all. I think it takes a less is more approach. And I think the show would do well in current incarnations to remember that at times.
Agreed.
But, you know, I differ from a lot of people on that.
Right. Both you and I were fans of season two, which is the slowest season.
Which is the slowest season, yes. I would argue season two is better than the everyone on the train tracks going to Terminus season. But that's just my opinion.
You know, he's going around the campsite here. And like you said, the restraint is big. One of the main reasons this show got made was the fact that Frank Darabont was attached. He is a prominent director in Hollywood, creator in Hollywood, had a lot of great credits to his name. He was kind of the engine.
Shawshank Redemption being, I think, the most
certainly
notable.
No question. One of the great films of the 90s. And he had the kind of cachet that got people interested in this project, I think. And now you see a shot that Darabont uses throughout this season, which is somebody looking under a vehicle. Rick is looking underneath the vehicle, and he sees, and here's a continuity bit for you, Nick, because I'd noticed this. Watch the zombie girl here. There's a little girl who's a zombie. She stops, and she's going to bend down right now and pick up a teddy bear. This bothered me on the rewatch, because that's not how we've been conditioned to feel that the walkers behave. This episode, I noticed, treats the walkers a little bit differently than later seasons do, because the walkers here seem to have some vague connection to their prior lives. In other words,
I think the argument would be made here that because the brain has not yet decayed to the level of the walkers in, you know, a lot of the walkers that we see in current incarnations of the show, that perhaps they are still retaining some sort of vague memory.
Perhaps so. It's just interesting because I don't, even on Fear the Walking Dead, I don't think that I've seen the walkers behave in a manner, particularly with Morgan's wife later, but they're picking up the bear because that actually takes effort and takes, you know, muscle reaction and stuff
right.
like that. But it's just interesting. It's not necessarily a knock on this. It's just I wonder if that's something they changed their mind on later on, or if, like you said, if it was intentional because it was so early into everything and
or if perhaps it was just something that Darabont was adamant about having.
True.
And, you know, as we all know, that his time on the show was
there
not,
was a big creative split at the end of season one between AMC and Robert Kirkman, and between Robert Kirkman and Frank Darabont, and AMC sided with Kirkman over Darabont, and which is understandable because it's Kirkman's property, and Darabont kind of exited. But this episode already, one of the things I was going to say is I viewed it very much like a movie. Like, it's very cinematic, less so than a television show, it felt like, and to the point where I was gripped and engaged the entire time, and, you know, obviously I knew there wasn't going to be a conclusion, but it really grabs you like it's telling you a complete story, even though it's an hour and 4 minutes long. The structure of the episode is the same kind of structure you get in a feature film.
Right, and I think some of that cinematography, that cinematic nature you mentioned, I think we have to say that, you know, assume a lot of that is due to Darabont, because I will say the show is still well shot, but I don't think it has been as well shot since season one. I think season one was the peak of the cinematography for this show.
Yeah, I would agree for the most part. I think they've come close to it a few times in the mid-season.
Not as consistently, though.
Sure,
as season
I agree.
One. Season one is almost... You know, is almost consistently just perfectly framed and has so many great shots. I mean, that shot of Rick riding on horseback into the wasteland of Atlanta is still like probably the show's most
iconic.
Yeah,
and it's right out of the comic.
You know, all these years
it's recreating an image directly from the comic, which happens a few times in this episode. The shot of him putting down the little girl a minute ago was terrific. Another thing that I really appreciated about this, and they do this in the book too, but to me it was better done here. Is establishing life before the apocalypse for Rick. Here he is in a police car with Shane, his best friend, who many people now will know from The Punisher on Daredevil, John Bernthal, and they're having just a you know empty, shallow conversation about women, as guys often do, and establishing pretty early in the episode some shall we say somewhat selfish tendencies from Rick's wife, Lori, where Rick says that Lori accused him of not even caring about her and Carl, which is great because that is totally something I could see Lori saying.
Absolutely. I think that's one, you know, you can quibble with this show at times in its handling of certain characters and consistency of those interpretations, but that's the one thing I got to give the showrunners. From day one, they knew that Lori was an insufferable bitch.
She's a
bitch. And they never backed down.
She's a mother.
And I would argue from day one, they knew that Shane was somewhat of a douche, but that's just
yeah,
my opinion.
I agree with that, actually. I think that, the thing about Shane is he seems like he genuinely cares about Rick. This seems like they're legitimately great friends, and they legitimately care about each other. But you know, we all have friends like Shane. You know, I mean, I have you for God's sake. So we all.
Oh, Ma. For God's sake.
There it is. So you know, but they've got a good friendly dynamic here. But you definitely get the impression that Shane's a little full of himself. That Shane's a little. I guess you would say black and white in his thinking. There's not a lot of shades of gray in Shane's world, whereas Rick is more of a thinker, more of a somebody who's got a lot of gray in his life. He's not really sure where his marriage is heading. He's not really sure where his life is heading. But he's a good guy, and he's trying to do the right thing, which is another thing I noticed about this episode, is Rick in this episode is just so much more likable than the Rick that we've had for the last two or three seasons on The Walking Dead.
Absolutely, but I would argue that you know that development
to a
somewhat unlikable Rick has been one that's largely in a reaction to the events that have occurred
around him. Certainly,
you know,
yeah, I would
the loss of his wife, the having to be a single parent, you know, some of the physical obstacles he's been put through. You know, it's it makes a level.
It
of
does.
Sense.
It truly does. I think the refreshing part here is that overall sense that deep down, no matter what he says or does around it, he's a good person trying to do good. And there are times on the show where I feel like they've lost track of that at times. But
gotta love Shane choosing to go with the gloves.
The gloves, yes.
An interesting fashion choice.
Certainly.
Here.
And now they're gonna. I had forgotten actually completely about this whole part about the idiot deputies that. You know, or just trying to get on World's Scariest Police Chases or whatever. I didn't remember that at all. I remember the shootout here vaguely, but these just podunk hick deputies that don't really know what they're doing.
You're very harsh on these deputies.
They don't know
Greg.
What they're doing. Listen, this guy, this Rick especially, well, Rick calls out this guy in a minute. This guy wants to be on World's Scariest Police Chases. And Rick says later on, he sees him later on, and he says, I never thought much of him. He was always a doofus or whatever. So, you know, they're waiting for this, you know, criminal to show up, I guess. And it's, I like this part. I thought this was a really great addition to the episode because it helps humanize all these people. It helps humanize Shane, helps humanize particularly Rick, and show what his life was like, and show you that. This is the kind of person we're dealing with. It's somebody that we can relate to, somebody we can get into. Because a lot of this show, as we know, is going to be him not interacting with anyone, him alone.
Yeah.
So you have to give people him interacting. You have to show him interacting with other people in order to establish what his personality is.
Yep, I agree. I will say that a revolver is an odd choice of a police weapon, considering the rate of fire for it. You would think an automatic weapon or a semi-automatic weapon would make a lot more sense, but I digress.
Well, as you know, sometimes in the plains of Georgia, it's difficult to find modern technology or advanced technology of any kind.
Sometimes you just want something that looks cool rather than it being practical.
Right, exactly. Where are they at in Georgia, by the way? Have they ever established that? They're not far from Atlanta.
Unnamed.
But.
Right, yeah. The idea is that Atlanta is a relatively safe distance away. Columbus, you would think, would be fairly close, given the constant mentions of Fort Benning as they get into later in this season and especially into season two. Terminus was eventually revealed to be somewhere in the middle part of the state. Now, this is a change from the comic, because my understanding is that in the comic, originally they were from Kentucky, I believe it was.
Yeah,
I think that's correct,
if I remember correctly.
And then they made the trip south to Atlanta from Kentucky, which is a lot further of a trip.
And there's the over-dramatic movie shootout, where the guy gets shot 400 times by the cops and slowly flails his arms. Outstanding. Reminiscent of a lot of my beloved 90s action films. Now we got a dude with a shotgun and a baseball hat. He's down.
Yeah, there he goes.
He did. Or we think he's dead anyway.
Rick's lying on the ground screaming, which is something we'll see constantly throughout the rest of the next seven years of our lives.
If this was anything past season four, we would have gotten a close-up of Rick's face as he writhed in agony.
Yep. And his beard continues to grow and turn gray.
You could just see the food particles hanging from his beard. And here's that guy shooting Rick in the side in a pretty graphic scene.
Yep. Bandana guy there shooting Rick, and the pulp flies out of the back.
Bandana guy looking like Bruce Springsteen's guitarist. But
I did find Shane's constant shushing of Rick here after he got shot to be a little weird.
You know, it comes off slightly erotic in nature.
Oh, I was about to say a little, especially that angle. It's
maybe
like,
there's a subtext.
I'm about to enter you now. You know, maybe.
And also, maybe. The only person that Rick remembers seeing in the hospital is Shane, who brings him flowers.
That's right.
You know, he doesn't even remember seeing.
I like to take that as the implication that Lori was so much of a bitch she never even visited Rick in the hospital.
Well, your dad's dead, Carl. Let's move on. Oh, another thing that I want to point out while I'm thinking about it. This episode was still early enough in the show that Carl was still Carl and had not yet evolved into Coral.
Rick's
parlance.
And as we'll get to a little bit later in the show, I think there's a golden missed opportunity as it pertains to Carl, but I'll get there in a little bit.
Here's Shane talking to Rick and
monologuing about a plant.
Yep, trying to... You know, Rick has clearly been in this coma for a while. This was something we talked about off the air, by the way, that we're interested in getting input on from the listening audience. We're not entirely sure how long Rick has been out.
What's the time period here?
Because clearly, from Shane's demeanor, it's been a while already at that point when Shane was visiting. So Shane's bringing him the flowers. Rick's now waking up from his coma, and the flowers have wilted. So I don't know how long, Nick, it takes flowers to wilt. I don't know that. I should know that. Go sue me, somebody. I don't know how flowers.
Well, I mean, it doesn't take them that long to wilt, but I would think, you know, if they would be completely dead by the time, you know, it had been an extended period of time, I would say those flowers probably, I don't know, a month maybe, if that. That's what I would think. Also, off topic, but if they ever do a live-action Saved by the Bell movie, I think John Bernthal should play A.C. Slater.
Because of the hair?
The hair, yep. The hair and the general appearance.
Yeah, well, you know, he's shaved his head down now, so to play Frank Castle, so who knows? You know, he could probably grow it back out again, I'm assuming, as an aged A.C. Slater.
There you go.
Who would you get to play Zach Morris, though? I mean, gosh.
Oh, who knows? I mean, any number of people you could go with. Any number of people.
Yeah, there you you see Rick with a beard, which you'll see.
Jonah Hill would, of course, play the modern-day version of Screech.
Yeah, he's certainly annoying enough.
Listen to you.
Now, the real question is, who would play Kelly? But that's another story for another time. This is really good by Andrew Lincoln. This perform, this whole hospital scene is outstanding, I thought. It really, I had forgotten how good it was. Because in my memory of this episode, he just wakes up and leaves the hospital. I didn't remember him just struggling and trying to call for a nurse that doesn't come to help him because the hospital has obviously been shut down due to the zombie apocalypse.
Right.
You know, he's, I mean, just really great facial expressions here from Andrew Lincoln as Rick.
Running Water's still up and running, which is interesting. I think a lot of times throughout the show that's been portrayed is none of the utilities are still still available.
And you see lights on too, so you know there's some kind of
generator. A lot of hospitals have their own generators though, so that that makes some level of sense. I think
the just a really good shot here of Rick walking down this abandoned hospital hallway that's all disheveled and.
And that's the thing I think we should mention here is that you know, you and I both love the show for its human elements, for its character interactions for the most part, but it also, especially in season one, is extremely effective as a genuine horror concept. I think in this pilot in particular, there are a lot of shots that are just staples of the horror genre. Whether it's like, you know, a shot like this, which is the deserted hallway, or it's
the flickering lights, you know, in the distance,
the flickering lights, just the way this thing's put together from a lighting and cinematography and set design standpoint reminds you of some of the classic horror films of the. What's the word I'm looking for? Of the, you know, when you have a variety of, a group of things that are similar, they fall into a certain category almost.
I believe the word you're looking for is genre!
There we go.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is a great horror episode. There are moments in this that even on rewatching it were genuinely scary, like particularly when he goes into the stairwell and there's no light at all.
I was about to say the stairwell and that's great because I've always been, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of horror in the world, but I've always found horror to be more effective when it's about what they're not showing you compared to what they are showing you. And so the tension in that scene that I think we're about to get, very, very.
He hasn't actually seen a walker yet. He doesn't know these zombies look like, that there actually are zombies, but the tension is there because you as the viewer know that they're there. And you know that he's in danger.
Absolutely. And then the great imagery here of the graffiti scrawled on what I am assuming. Never mind, it's paint.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it is blood and these sorts of
things. This reminds me almost of the original Resident Evil game. Some of the lighting, some of the shots that game scared the bejesus out of me when I was in middle school when I first played it. So this episode's got a lot of those elements. Great shot of the zombie hand going through that. An interesting choice by Rick here because for all he knows, these are actual people trying to, you know, malnourished people trying to push through, but he just leaves and is content to leave them in there. But I understand it because he's terrified. I would be too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so here's the stairwell scene that we mentioned earlier. Mostly goes dark. You've got just a little bit of light, you know, that's provided here by this book of matches that he's found, and this is just a very, very well done sequence.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to explain how effective it is at creating horror. Now they can be a really scary show, but a lot of times they go more for that, like you said, that dramatic element of the human relationships kind of thing.
And increasingly in recent seasons, they've gone more for the gore and violence and gross out aspects of the zombie genre rather than the legitimate horror aspects, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree. And even some action, they've had some pretty action heavy episodes in recent years as well. So they've really run the gamut, and that's, I think, part of the appeal, I guess, of having a show that's run as long as it is and that's as secure as it is you can really experiment with a ton of different genres and focus on a different one in a different episode if you choose to. Another great shot here where Rick goes outside into the light, and it's that great interpretation of when you've been in the dark and you first see the light, the natural light again, and it blinds you and you can't really see where you're going. You know, and it is a very good scary concept. And hold on, wait a minute. We have been joined by a guest. Oh, my goodness gracious. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm just going to let this guest say whatever he wants to say. He just walked into our studio here. A little rude, but you know what? He's royalty. I'll let him do it. You know, hi there, true believers. When I created Doctor Strange, I thought to myself, I told Steve Ditko, I said, I want to create a character that really encompasses horror because I was scared and I wanted the audience to be scared. And so when I told that flight attendant to remove her trousers, as I did that one day, she said no, and I was terrified that she was going to alert the authorities. So originally, my character, Dr. Strange, was supposed to be afraid of an impending lawsuit. Ditko changed it, and the rest is history. Well, thank you, Mr. Lee. That was very, very informative. Nick, did you read about any of that in your History of Marvel book?
No, I did not read about any of that's the untold story of the untold story. So
there you have
it. Interesting. Guess that one didn't make it through the editors.
Yeah, I guess not. I mean, you know, it seems like it wouldn't have been a very good ongoing series. I mean,
all right. So here's a question to get back on topic. Do you believe that this helicopter here is the same helicopter seen later in the episode and later in subsequent episodes?
You know. I feel uncomfortable even commenting because I feel like. Are you referring to the helicopter that crashes later in the episode?
Yes.
I feel like they did an episode about that helicopter in a later season. I honestly don't remember either. I
know it was a recurring deal in the comics where that helicopter kept popping up over and over again to the point of. Uniqueness, some might say.
As if it were intentional, you might say.
Intentional and not really that interesting. But we will talk about the comic upon which
the
show is based.
Are you suggesting that at times
now,
The Walking Dead may not be the most subtle of comics?
I would suggest we will discuss that.
I am thinking right
now
that
time.
You are thinking that. And I am telling you that I am thinking that that you are thinking that, and I feel a certain way about the way that you're thinking that I'm thinking that you're thinking, and I'm telling you all the things that I'm thinking. But we'll get to that next.
But we always have to tell you; it has to be told.
I have to tell you that I'm thinking
directly
at a given time.
Yes,
I'm feeling it. This is great. Rick comes back to his home to try to find Lori and Carl, not Cor.
And here is the missed opportunity, Greg. If I were doing this scene today, I'd do it this way. Rick walks in. He's looking around. He's looking through his house. And he finally goes into the kitchen, and he finds both his wife and child dead on the floor.
How are they dead?
Zombie bite. And then gunshot to the head for both. That's what I would have gone with. That's just me.
Quite frankly, you are... you have been on record many times with your... of the character of Carl. Not Carl Childers.
What?
Carl Grimes.
No. Oh, man. That's what the Walking Dead universe needs is Carl Childers, and then you just turn the show into Carl and Eugene running around having wacky hijinks together.
Reckon I aim to kill you with it. Gonna need an ambulance and a hearse.
But no, this is a very well done scene. This shows you the despair of a man who thinks he's lost pretty much everything, and who is questioning his own sanity at this point as well.
I have to say this as well, because I love the actors on the show today even, but I do feel like there are times when The Walking Dead almost becomes a parody of itself at times with some of the over-the-top performances, even from Andrew Lincoln, sometimes can go a little over-the-top, whether it be with the accent or with whatever. He is incredible in this episode.
Pretty much the entire first two seasons, Andrew Lincoln.
And he's still good today. He's still very good. It's just...
Right, but it's a different character. Yeah. Like it's a different character. It's a different portrayal.
This is a level of humanism that we don't see in Rick probably after season two. just right. just incredible. His confusion here of seeing this guy walking towards him, outstanding. I mean, I can't say enough about how great he is in this episode, how much he owns it. But as great as he is, it's not even the best performance in this episode, and I'll get to that.
I don't agree with that, but I do agree there are other dynamic performances that we are about to get into.
Not the least of which, this shovel right here.
Boom. What a blow. Right there.
Right in the kisser.
Oh. Got busted.
This kid's excited to kill Rick. He's just excited.
And why wouldn't he be? Why wouldn't he be excited to kill Rick?
That's a good question. Now here comes Lenny James as Morgan. Lenny James was a big draw for me on this pilot episode because he was playing the character, the villain Baptiste, the primary villain of the show Human Target, which I have verbally filleted on countless occasions, along with Russell Sellers. An outstanding comic book show from 2010, 2011, I think. So he was, I think, in season 2 of Human Target at this time, and played the character of Baptiste. He was amazing, really blew me away in that. And here he is playing a drastically different character, a man who has a much better grasp of what's going on than Rick does. He decides to help Rick out. Once he figures out that Rick is still alive, he makes sure that he isn't bitten, and he's raising his son in this house. They've got all the windows boarded up. They seem to know what they're doing. They seem to have a pretty good little system here. They decide to let Rick in, and this is a man who has had to watch his wife turn into a zombie and didn't have the heart to put her down, which forms a lot of the moral crux of this episode and would end up playing a big factor in upcoming seasons. So yeah, but at this point Morgan is very, you know, as much as anyone could be, is well adjusted to what's happened. He just can't find the courage to put his wife down, but he knows what's going on. He's got a handle on things. He's helping Rick out and didn't really have to. So instantly there's this bond, this unspoken bond that forms between Rick and Morgan. I say instantly, it really forms over the course of this episode, because at first, you know, they're a little, understandably, a little tense around each other. Rick doesn't know what's going on. Morgan doesn't know that Rick doesn't know what's going on. But really good acting here. Lenny James is spectacular. Absolutely spectacular. He and Lincoln do a great job of playing off each other.
And from a plotting standpoint, it helps to have a character like Morgan who has some knowledge that he can impart upon both Rick and the viewer. He kind of informs you of what the status quo of this world is and kind of the basics of how everything works rather than you having to put it together yourself. It's exposition done well.
Yes.
Undoubtedly it is exposition, but exposition isn't always
a bad
thing.
No, in fact, you need exposition. I mean, exposition is we use it as a bad term a lot of times, but you have to have exposition or else the viewer doesn't know what the hell is going on and you end up with something like
right.
Final Crisis. You need exposition, and this does it really well. I would argue, and we'll get to this at another time, at times the book does not do exposition well, but we don't want to get it.
We are tiptoeing so hard around what's going to happen.
We're drawing some controversy on ourselves, Nick, is what we're doing. I don't want to,
before we even deserve it.
We don't want that yet. But what I'm saying is the show, especially in this episode, but at times the show does a much better job of. I'll just say the show does a very good job of expository dialogue at times, and
the show is well paced.
Yes, and this episode is well paced. And this episode's
yes,
because it's dialogue driven. It's a conversation driven episode, but it never feels boring. Maybe that's just me. Maybe a lot of people are boring.
No. I mean that's our own biases showing through, Greg. I mean we just did reading and watching where we talked about how much we love books or comic books that are based entirely around conversations. We've talked before about how we love the episodes of The Walking Dead. Like this to us, in our opinions, this is when The Walking Dead
yes.
is at its best. Not when it's dealing with, you know, gore and guts. Not when it's dealing with ridiculously over-the-top characters and concepts. You know, it. This is when it shines. This is what the heart of the show is about. It's about that human yep. element and finding one's humanity in the face of
that,
horrific
that's
circumstances.
A great misreading of The Walking Dead, in my opinion. It's never, ever... And Kirkman has talked about this. Even the books. It's never been about the zombies. It's always been about the people. It's about how people right. react to the world around them and the people around them. And like you said, this is the show, in my opinion, at its best. And the thing about dialogue-driven properties, you can get... If it's dialogue-driven and there's no progression of character or story, then it's boring and it sucks. But if it's dialogue-driven and it's progressing the story or it's progressing the characterizations, I'm all for it. And this is a case of the latter. This is a case where it's driving the story, really. You know, you need these conversations. You need to believe in these characters, to know who these characters are, what makes them tick, and what makes this world inhabitable by those who are there.
Absolutely. But to circle back around to Lenny James for a moment, I will agree with you. He gives an outstanding performance here. And one thing I noticed, or not really noticed, but just appreciated in this episode, because this is really the last time we see Morgan for some time in the show. You know,
the next
time episode,
he pops
you know, he
up, he's a crazy lunatic guy.
And I was about to say, going back and watching it, I loved how I noticed in the pilot now, you know, that level of attachment he has to his son. And there's aspects of his performance that give you the impression that his son is the only thing keeping him, you know, keeping him together and keeping him sane. And so it really shows you a job well done from a character development standpoint, that you can understand very easily how he became the guy that we see when he pops up again in season
three, I believe. And the character progression of Morgan is something that I was really a big fan of. I think they've done a good job with that. You and I both were fans of the Morgan-centric episode from this past season or the season before, whenever it was.
Yeah. I still think Morgan as a Jedi is a little weird, but the episode itself was extremely
yes,
well done.
With the that other guy in it that I can't remember the name of ever. But this is an episode that shows you the connection between Morgan and his son, and it's drawing parallels, I think, between how Rick views himself.
Wishes his relationship with
Which his relationship was with Carl, exactly. So I think that's one of the reasons why Rick attaches himself so quickly and strongly to Morgan and his son, is he sees in them what he wants for himself. And, you know, it's really well explored here. You're also getting more into the horror elements here, where you're hearing noises outside. What are these noises? What's going on? You know, the car alarm's going off, I believe. It's continuing off of some of the scary elements that were done earlier, and Rick is learning more and more about these walkers and how they operate.
Absolutely. And this is kind of what this scene you mentioned earlier, where you get hints of, you know, the idea that these walkers in this episode and in this season operate a little bit differently than we have been led to believe
in later seasons.
In more recent seasons, yeah.
A lot of this was pretty much done away with by the second season, which, like you said, maybe it was even. You know, I have to go back and rewatch season one, but maybe it was even done away with in later episodes. But maybe it was a Frank Darabont vision of how these walkers operate, because here you see Morgan's wife, and she clearly still has some connection to the house. She keeps walking to the window, to the house, even jiggling the door handle. And it, you know, it's really interesting.
It almost makes you wonder if they, whose decision it was. Like you said, it wasn't intentional that this went away, or was the decision made consciously to drop this aspect of the walkers at some point? Because I wonder if there'd be some interesting storytelling potential. They could have done with this in later seasons.
I agree. And it could be either one. It could have been an intentional, you know, they gradually lose that as they go on. But I almost wonder if you're right about them consciously dropping it, because I've, from what I've read of Kirkman in interviews, Kirkman has always seemed very, very almost dismissive of the actual walkers. Like, he's talked about he's not interested in revealing what caused the outbreak. He's not interested in ever revealing a cure for the outbreak or anything like that. So I think that his concern might have been that if you start to humanize the walkers, you increase the need to introduce a cure or to go back and explain how it happened or whatever. And I feel like for whatever reason, he's not interested in doing that necessarily.
That's a good point. That's a great point, actually. But nonetheless, like you said, a very effective scene here later, or in, you know, that we just had. And she will pop up again in what I would argue is probably the best scene of the
I think you could make a strong argument for that being one of the best scenes ever in The Walking Dead. Like, if you're putting together a top five, it would easily make the top five.
Right. To me, I think that's the scene that really, like, I enjoyed the pilot the first time I saw it, and I was enjoying it up until that point. And, we'll talk about the scene when we get there, but I think that was the moment at which I went, oh, man. This is what the show is, you know?
Yeah, it blew me away even on the rewatch. Really, it is a hard scene to watch in the best way. Very, very good. Now let's talk more on a macro level here of looking at the episode and how it holds up in the context of what we have seen in the years since. You know, we talked about. We've been watching the show from the beginning. We watch every episode and ups, downs, everything in between. From, you know, arguably the best episode, the Look at the Flowers episode, to the arguably the worst, which came right before it, the Rick and Carl eating pudding episode. You know, we've seen the ups and downs, but how did this hold up for you in the context of, I'm sure that you probably haven't seen it in a while. I hadn't seen it in many years. So how did this hold up for you compared to your expectations and your remembrances of it?
Extremely well. My memory of it was that it was, you know, the pilot was really what hooked me on the show. And that the pilot was so strong that I was willing to see season one out to its ending. And season one kind of had me on the hook from there. I mean, season one, I know a lot of people have some issues with, particularly, I think, the nursing home subplot. Yeah. But I would say that season one, what for me anyway, was effective enough that it pretty much had me on the hook at that point. And the show has never really dipped, in my opinion, dipped far enough to get me off the hook. It is starting off probably this upcoming season on the shakiest footing it's ever been on with me. But still, season one kind of set a bar, and more particularly this pilot set a bar. That it's pretty much met. I mean, for the most part since then, this is just a well done show, and this pilot really, like I said, sets the template for what Walking Dead does well. It does character interactions, it does tension, and it does legitimate emotional stakes well. You know, like I said, the horror concepts are done well, but that's something the show has chosen intentionally, for whatever reason, not to focus on as much in recent years. But, you know, when it's doing guts and gore, it's not really that. To me, that's not the appeal of the show. And I think this pilot is almost a perfect, you know, just a perfect sample of, you know, what this show is.
And I think why people attach to it so quickly and why it got into the pop culture lexicon was not simply that it had zombies in it, because if that was the case, the zombie fad would have started 10-15 years earlier, whether it be Dawn of the Dead, whether it be whatever, you know, 28 Days Later, whatever zombie feature that you can think of, that would have started a big fad. What made this show so successful, in my opinion, is not that it was about zombies, it's that the characters were clearly defined. That when you watch this show, it was a show filled with largely interesting characters interacting in an interesting manner, and everybody had a character they could attach to, they could identify.
And here's something the show does exceptionally well. The show has never, you know, gone for laughs, I don't think, but it does provide moments of levity, which are needed from the bleak and the dark, you know, the dark tone that the show typically has. And I thought the shower scene right here was a much needed break from the very
somber,
you know, very somber and oppressive tone that the show had taken from almost.
You mentioned earlier that how you would have changed one thing about this episode and had Carl and Lori be killed in the house. If I could change one thing, if I were directing this episode and writing it, my one thing that I would change is here in this shower scene that we just watched, I would have had from a closet emerge the character of Axel, who would have been hiding at the police station, and then he would befriend Rick and Morgan, and they would have about an hour's worth of funny conversations listening to Axel's incredibly impressive stories of his family.
Indeed. Axel is the one throwaway side character that nobody remembers that Greg just has a... He has a
Axel is my boy, and I think it's also the most heartbreaking moment in the entire show when he's in the middle of telling an awesome story and he gets killed. And I still want to know how he finishes that story. He also was the first to make the observation that, as you know, the character of Carol indeed has the short hair.
She does have the short hair. Perhaps. Not to tell tales out of skewl, but perhaps we'll talk more about Axel on your whenever we get to our countdown of our top five Walking Dead characters.
You know, it'll be tough for him to make the list, but he might be in the running. We'll see. I agree with you. It holds up very, very well. The episode actually held up better than I even remembered it. I remembered it being good. I didn't remember it being as great as it is. This is a really...
And it really is great. And I love how they kept this plot point, the walkie-talkie. It's almost like they had a plan, a long-term plan for this, and they stuck to it, and they executed it brilliantly.
And it also adds a layer of tragedy to all this, because I had forgotten about this conversation that Rick and Morgan had, and Morgan literally tells Rick a few days. Like, he's going to be behind him in a few days. He just wants to give the kid time to learn to shoot. And as we know how it all turns out, apparently pretty much immediately after Rick leaves town is when everything goes to hell and for Morgan. So really, really heartbreaking, right. Really tragic the way things play out, because if Rick could have just convinced him to go right now and leave together, you know, who knows how things would have turned out. So that's another thing The Walking Dead does well, is create these what-if scenarios of these horrible, tragic events that could have been avoided but for one decision that goes the wrong way. So, really good job of that. And there's the doofus cop I was telling you about earlier that Rick puts down. He dead.
Mm-hmm. And the blood pours out the back of the head.
Yep. Oh, there he goes. He dead. So, or I guess he undead, in fact.
In any event, there you see him go their separate ways, and Rick takes off, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, this leads almost directly into... Oh, never mind, okay, so we got the Morgan scene first.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're pretty much taking place simultaneously. This is just Morgan smiling, I think, if I remember correctly. Yep. Doing a Reginald Vell Johnson right there. Smiling and nod.
But the impression I get is that Rick leaving the police station leads directly pretty much into the scene we saw from the opening. Is that pretty much what we get?
Yeah, that's the implication I got. Because he runs out of gas, and he's looking to siphon off gas, which does not work. Now he's going back to revisit that first corpse that he saw, the upper torso lady, as I'll call her, and put her out of her misery, I guess you would say. Which, again, nice touch, because it establishes the level of compassion that Rick has.
And establishes what this version of Rick is all about, yeah.
And it actually, now that I'm thinking about it, the way you put it earlier, it actually kind of does make me appreciate the character development a little bit more, because it makes you see, because the Rick that we have today is so different than this, and it makes you think back to everything that's happened in the interim, and how that has changed him and hardened him and, warped him the way that life sometimes warps good people.
Right. And especially with under circumstances such as these, you almost have to, understand that that level of warping. Oh man, these Morgan scenes here, they're good stuff.
Yeah, this is we're getting pretty close to the scene we were talking about earlier. He's giving a tour de force performance, Lenny James, just
silently without saying a word.
I'm so glad you mentioned silently, Nick, because that was something I wanted to address when I was rewatching this episode in preparation last night. I wanted to comment on the use of silence in this episode.
Yes, long stretches of no dialogue,
no sound effects,
no sound effects, no music. Yep.
It really works. It sounds like it wouldn't work, but boy, does it work. The scene of Rick.
And it's something they haven't really done since season one. I mean, pretty much since Darabont left the show, they've chosen to continuously score everything, which isn't a problem per se. But I think here at times that silence, adds to that level of tension that I
silence
I
is gold
throughout the show.
Some might say absolutely from Deutschland, but it really adds that sense of dread, I guess you would say. When Rick wakes up in the hospital to silence, when Morgan's looking at photos, there are periodic uses of silence in this episode that really help everything. This is just incredible. What a performance.
Yep.
Morgan, now here's a question for you, Nick. This is the last time we mentioned that we see Morgan for more than two seasons. Do you think that it was a mistake to not make him a recurring character in the show? Or do you think it played out just perfectly the way it was?
I think it's worked out. I think his when he makes his appearance in season three, I think it's a necessary move to show what could have become of Rick if he had never rejoined his family. I think Morgan is there to provide that counterpoint, that analog, if you will. I think, that season three episode where he pops back up is one of my favorites of the entire show. So I'm not going to complain too much about the way they chose to pace this out with Morgan.
Yeah, and you see, this is a fine scene here where Rick's putting down the zombie, but honestly, it's all about the Morgan scene here. Just amazing.
It really is, yeah.
So you could almost... It almost feels as if after that Morgan scene that we're talking about where he can't make the decision to put down his wife, which of course ends up being a tragic decision, when he can't make this decision and he puts down the rifle, it almost feels like the episode should end there, but it doesn't.
Right, because this was, a 90-minute premiere originally. So this feels very much like where they might have ended the episode had it been just, a one-hour pilot, but it has some additional time there and some time that is kind of vital to setting up what the status quo of the show is going to be going forward and kind of introducing you to the characters who will make up the supporting cast throughout the rest of season one.
Oh man, when they make eye contact, he and the corpse of his wife make eye contact. Crazy. Really good.
Yeah. This is tough.
But yeah, this is an episode that encompasses really, like you said, like we've talked about this entire episode, encompasses the good of The Walking Dead and what hooked people on it from the get-go. And, as much as I enjoy the show now, and I do, man, I'm almost like, I wonder if they could even possibly recapture this kind of feeling again, because the world is so expansive now and it's so wide open and we know so much about the walkers and
we've gotten into, granted, I haven't read all of the comic books. I've read, what I would consider to be my fair share of them.
Careful, Nick.
And I'm trying my best. And I would say that we've reached a point in the show where we are starting to pull in some concepts from the comics that, for my tastes, feel a little bit too over the top and kind of move the story.
Hold on, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but Dale and his eyebrows just appeared for the first time in his stupid hat. Here he is waddling. I love
it. Oh, my God. Now, are we really going to have the Dale debate?
Listen,
is that what we're going to have
I'm
to
just
do?
Saying, if you were making a list of Walking Dead characters, I would have no problem with you having Dale's eyebrows as a totally separate character.
Yes, I totally see.
Anyway, carry on. I didn't mean to interrupt you, sir. I just couldn't resist.
No, I would argue that the show has started to move towards some of the more outlandish concepts from the comics, which I know it's ridiculous to complain about things being outlandish in a book about, you know, zombies walking around. But, you know, things like Ezekiel and his pet tiger, or Michonne and her pet zombies, and various different things that keep the show from being a more grounded humanistic approach, in my opinion. So.
Shane carrying an axe for something.
To answer the answer to your original question was, can the show move back to what it was here? And I say no, because I think they've opened Pandora's box
right.
to some of those more comic book
sure,
esque concepts.
I agree. And the better episode, weirdly enough, though, still like once a season they'll have that episode that's kind of like this. That's very like slow and personal. Like I apologize for not knowing the episode name, but the Look at the Flowers episode. Very much felt like it would have fit in on season one in terms of the
Absolutely.
Pacing of it. But yeah, and there you see a very... Man, it's weird to see him so young, Carl. Like, he looks like he's what? How old would you say he is here? 7, maybe? 8?
Ripe for killing, I
Well, know. Shane did just have an axe for some reason. I guess he was chopping wood somewhere, but...
Also, I'm pretty sure... that now that Shane is out of uniform, we will never see his top button buttoned again throughout
no,
the rest of the show.
I don't know if that's for the ladies' benefit or what, watching the show, but Shane's not fond of that top button there.
Is he wearing a necklace
on it? Yeah, I wonder what... I noticed that on the rewatch last night. I was going to ask you what the significance is if that pops up again. I can't remember.
I got two theories just off the top of my head. One, it's a reference to a caliber of bullet. Two, and this is the one I like better. Shane is such a douche that he would still be obsessing over his high school athletic glory that it's actually his jersey number from his good old football days back
Shane
in high school.
Shane does seem like the type that would do that.
Yes, that's why, and that's the one I'm going with. You can't tell me any different.
It would be interesting if that was the caliber of bullet that put Rick in the coma. I don't know. I'm not saying that's the
would
case.
Be interesting.
But,
and here's Shane doing one of the douchiest things he can possibly do.
And Lori just pulling a Lori.
It's Lori being Lori at this point.
If enough time had passed, I don't think there's an issue here. I think the issue is we don't feel that there would have been more than what a month, maybe 2 months that have passed since all this has happened.
Note to self: tell Danielle not to invite Greg to my funeral. While I die.
What makes you think you'll die before me, anyway?
Well, just a feeling.
One of us will get hit by the cholesterol once in a while. Or eventually, I should say. Or once in a while. Hell, I don't care.
Multiple times throughout our lives.
Oh,
but
God.
No, you know, just... Lori is just... As we didn't know this at the time. We were like, oh, well, maybe she's got a reason for being the way she is. Nope. She
and
does not.
Eventually...
At least not one that is well
and
defined.
And eventually, she will end up driving both the men in her life completely insane.
Absolutely. And doing such wonderful things as telling Rick, you've got to do something about Shane. And then when he tries to do something about Shane,
what the hell are you doing to Shane?
And
then telling Shane, you need to leave me and Carl alone. And then when Shane leaves her and Carl alone, telling Shane, why won't you hang out with Carl? And also never watching her son.
Her son, who is constant, like, is obsessed with just not doing whatever he's told.
He doesn't afraid of anything. Shane coming across, or not Shane, Rick coming across the first of what would be approximately 4,000 mysterious houses on The Walking Dead.
Yes, there's never enough, there's never a shortage of mysterious houses, but I guess that makes sense if the world
I guess
is
that,
dying,
yeah,
you
it
know?
Does make sense. I really loved what they did here of establishing... And a lot of this is, this is a tough scene to watch too. It's just nasty. Ugh. the flies buzzing around the corpses and whatnot. But Andrew Lincoln does a great job of selling the disgust in this episode. Obviously, by now, they've all been around it so much that, you know, they can eat a steak dinner while blowing zombie guts everywhere. But this is somebody who's experiencing all this for the first time, and you can see just how disgusted he is by everything he's seeing and smelling.
Absolutely. And so this this little sequence here at the house leads to one of the more, like we said, iconic images from not just this pilot, but one that is pulled directly from the comics, because this is where Rick first encounters his noble
steed. And I know that we said at the beginning that we probably wouldn't get through this whole episode, but you've been listening this long, folks, and if you're still listening, yes, this is a really long episode. We've only got 10 minutes left to go in this episode of Walking Dead, so we're just going to finish it out.
Yeah, Why not?
Why the hell not?
Why not at this point?
We bored you for 6 hours with the Fantasy Comics draft, so...
And quite frankly, folks, there's nothing wrong with a time
draw
limit.
And we haven't even mentioned that, you know, this episode of Off the Page, you know, talking about The Walking Dead, Days Gone By, is, of course, part of the longest-running weekly,
comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation pop history. We continue to get better and better at that as the
we're a regular Simon and Garfunkel with our harmony on that one.
We really are. And in case you're wondering, you know, for our off the pages in the past, we've often chosen things that are, you know, somewhat controversial, somewhat unique. Some might say aren't of the highest quality, and I think you're finding out why, because when we do things that we really love like this, we're just sitting here watching it, getting
reabsorbed into it.
Because it's so good, and this is Farley, this pilot.
The Chris Farley show. You remember Rick riding on his horse? That's awesome. That's good.
And it was, and here's the shot. Here
right out of the comic.
That we've referenced a couple of times. I still sell posters to this. I mean, it's probably, in terms of the show, I would have to say this is still the most iconic image in the show.
Yeah, either that or the fat walker being ripped in half by the rope in season 2 as he's being pulled out of the well. If you remember that one.
No. I feel like you were just saying something to say something.
They're trying to pull the fat... They spend the whole episode trying to pull the fat walker out of the well. And he's so fat that he rips in half from the weight. Oh, it's good. Oh, it puts me in a good humor.
And I believe all of this stuff was actually shot on location in Atlanta, which, I don't want to, you know, for those of you who haven't been to Atlanta recently, the idea that they were able to actually accomplish these deserted city streets is a logistical nightmare.
I can't imagine it. I nearly had a panic attack the last time I was in this area of Atlanta, so I can only imagine how they managed to clear the streets for this long.
Right. What's really interesting here is that, you know, the concept of Rick just kind of wandering through the city and there not being a single walker in sight, just not something we would have probably seen in later seasons of the show, because you get the impression in later seasons that the walkers are so constantly present that this
and
just
that there are
feasible.
Many there are even more walkers, presumably, because, you know, at this time there are presumably even more survival groups and things like that, but as the seasons go on they seem to be dwindling and more getting killed, the horse being frightened by the walkers and instinctually knowing that they're bad news is pretty cool too. That's something that a lot of and I don't know if it's like that in real life or not. I think it kind of is, but a lot of Hollywood features play with that idea of animals sensing danger before humans do. So that's kind of cool. And why does that walker look suspiciously like Gary Busey?
I don't know. That's a good question. This, you know, one thing that we haven't really mentioned here is I believe it was still Greg Nicotero doing a lot of the visual effects, a lot of the makeup. Here from the get-go, and, you know, just he's done a phenomenal job, and he, you know, in the year since has been able to really experiment more. And like I said, I don't, you know, the gore and the guts isn't what does it for me, but I can't deny that he does some amazing, amazing work on the show.
Yeah, and, especially some of the work that he's done with the transformations, I guess you would say. People that are kind of in between states, or they're turning
various states of decay, I guess you're saying. But, you know, you better be careful about being in a state of decay. You might get
it's not a good time to be associated with the word decay right now. Some might suggest that there's a word to describe them and their current state. Obsolete, perhaps.
Perhaps. And here you go. He comes up on what would be the precursor to the concept of the herd, you know, that they would delve into more in later seasons. And this is a pretty thrilling chase sequence, actually. Claustrophobic, even though it's taking place in the wide open air. I mean, this is a well done scene. And this poor horse has to bite the bullet for Rick's stupidity.
Oh, I know. I felt bad for the horse. Even at the time, the poor horse getting mauled because of Rick. Not the first time, by the way, that something bad will befall a character in the show because of Rick's stupidity.
No, it is not.
Particularly when it comes to making plans.
He's going to... And what we're going to do is we're going to herd the zombie herd through a loop-the-loop. And around, and then up and down, and then back around again.
How are we going to get back? We'll worry about that when we get there. It's a good plan.
Why are we doing this again? We have to.
But why? I mean, seems like we were doing pretty well for the last, 6 months or so. We just have to. We have to introduce conflict when there was none. Good Lord.
But yeah, that's well done. You know, you mentioned earlier going back to the idea of that shot of people under vehicles. You know, this is another example of that.
And the near suicide scene, really.
Yeah, until he looks up and sees the golden opportunity.
This was
here.
A good classic also, George Romero style scare here with the soldier.
Right. Yep. And I loved how they portrayed the idea of actually firing a gun in the tank, because it would not, having been in one before, would not be a wise move on anyone's part.
Completely disorients Rick.
Yep.
Leads him to making yet another foolhardy decision of deciding to peek out of the top of the tank.
I also will say this is not a realistic portrayal of the interior of a tank. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, it looks remarkably cozy in there.
That actually is probably... It's being depicted as far more space on the inside of that thing.
Yeah,
than they would
that's
actually
what I that's what I was suspecting. There's Gary Busey zombie.
Ah, and there's the bag of guns that would play a key role in the in your favorite episode of season one, the nursing home episode.
We're an angry
I never understood
Latino
your level
gang,
of hatred for that
but
episode.
We care about our grandparents.
Listen, man, it's the weakest episode of season one, but it's not a bad episode. It's just it's just there.
It's a bad.
In my opinion,
I thought you were going to say in my ass, but. You passed up. You took the approach. I appreciate that.
Quite frankly, I'd suggest that if that's the route you want to go.
If you want to drag the show into the gutter, that's your decision.
And you're right. Oh, and so we got Rick here kind of trying to contemplate just what in the hell he should do. And it's at this point I think we're going to get, the big... The big cliffhanger that would set up, the rest of the motion.
Yeah,
really,
which is,
the
of course,
season,
the scene
so.
When they shockingly cut away to Sylvester Stallone literally hanging off a cliff, which was a shocking turn of events in The Walking Dead, I thought.
I thought they were going to, they were going to do the radio bit here, who's on the radio and Who would it be?
Frank Stallone.
Frank Stallone.
Yep. Yep. The well, one of the things we almost have to bring this question up because, although it's, you know, obvious in our case, a lot of people who watch Walking Dead like to, you know, ask their friends, you know, oh, what would we do in the zombie apocalypse? What would we do if we were in this situation? I'll go ahead and answer for on behalf of Nick and myself. We'd die very quickly.
Die very quickly. You know, what was Zombieland, the rules that he had?
Cardio
was so important in that.
One of the most important, you know, rules. And as we mentioned earlier in the episode, not our strong point.
Not
obscure
our strong point. Nope.
Pop culture knowledge, strong point. Physical conditioning, right. Not a strong point.
Not a strong point. Let's be honest, Greg. We're men of average size.
Average skills.
Average speed. Average athleticism. Average intelligence.
Average carpentry skills.
Carpentry skills. Yep. We wouldn't be very useful.
Especially since I can't even, you know, I have an issue with when I'm being chased by things. My left hand won't work. The significance of that, that's the hand that I used to open beer with.
There you go. There you go. That's the hand that Greg uses to open beer with. I feel like my only real, like, contribution during the zombie apocalypse would I would be the guy leading the charge for just kill them. Don't trust anyone.
DTA.
Kill them all.
Stun their ass.
That's right.
That's who would be great in a zombie apocalypse, right. Is Stone Cold Steve Austin.
What about Stone Cold Dan Quinn?
Stone Cold Dan Quinn. Yeah, that's a good... I mean, certainly if he was still alive in the zombie apocalypse, you'd still be posting that horribly photoshopped image of Austin's head on... or Quinn's head on Austin's body.
Now, don't forget the t-shirt as well.
That's true. That's very good. That's very good. Well, folks, this brings us to the end of The Walking Dead episode Days Gone By. And if you obviously have noticed by now, we loved it. It holds up very, very well. If you, for some reason, have been living in a rock and you haven't ever watched The Walking Dead...
Yeah. Or even if you have, I mean, I think it's a good exercise to go back and kind of revisit this episode and just kind of see how much the show... I mean, the show has changed. I mean, the concept is the same, but the show, the execution of it has changed so much in 7 years. It's good to revisit this and kind of see what the initial vision of it was.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's interesting to go back on. I know several people that have kind of stopped watching the show over the years, and I know some people that started watching the show later. So definitely worth your time to go back and watch this episode. It's really, really good example of how to hook people on a concept, how to sell people on a concept, and to not do it in a cheap manner, to not do it with just a lot of convenient twists or what have you, just compelling characters, tense direction, great usage of the actors, the sound effects, everything in between, the makeup, just a great example of how to kick off an exciting new project. And it made a huge impact on the comic book industry because this show brought the book The Walking Dead to the top of the sales charts, made it a perpetual top selling book, brought a new level of success, a new period of sustained success for Image Comics, which is the publisher of The Walking Dead, and of course made Robert Kirkman one of the most powerful people in the comic book industry.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been, you know, it's been something of a game changer. It's brought new audiences in. It's brought new readers into comic shops in a way that, you know, no independent comic, to my knowledge anyway, has ever really been able to match. So Walking Dead is still a force to be reckoned with, and that, of course, is one of the many reasons that we are dedicating an entire month to it. And with that in mind, Greg, what do we got next week? Is next week Countdown?
I believe
or is
next
it
week
Book
is
Hunters?
The Long Book Hunters. Next week is the Long Book Hunters, and we are going to be looking at the Walking Dead Compendium, and particularly we're going to be looking at the first two chapters of the Walking Dead Compendium, which comprises the first two trade volumes of the Walking Dead. And we are going to actually be joined in that episode by Jennifer Smith, of the Geek and Sassy podcast, which you can catch right here on Place to Be Nation Pop. A new episode is out this week. Be sure to check that out. She's going to be joining us for that. She may be joining us again during Walking Dead month. We'll get back to you on that. But yeah, so we're going to be looking at that compendium, and we may have some comments that won't be controversial, and some comments that, quite frankly, may not be bought by the viewing audience.
And, you know, Greg, I'm glad you mentioned, you know, quite frankly, things not being bought, because I almost forgot that you and I had intended to address something that I feel like needs to be addressed. You know, recently, you know, I'm sure you guys who have listened to our podcast and those other podcasts here on the Place to Be Nation Pop feed have noticed there's been something of a professional rivalry between, you know, ourselves and the good folks over at the Sellers Points podcast. And, you know, they had, you know, our good friend Russell Sellers had some unique things to say about the origin of our you know, top three, bottom one concept. And, you know, I was not aware of any discussion with Greg, and Greg, I think, actually wanted to tell the story of that conversation as he remembers it.
Yes, as I recall, the two of us, myself and Mr. Sellers, Russell, my good friend, we were talking about this concept, and I was like, you know, hey, we need to come up with a concept, an idea of you know, a way that we can pare down the books that we've read and not make it too long. And he said, why don't you just, you know, come up with a list, you know, maybe your top three or four books of the month, and maybe talk about, you know, a couple books that you didn't like. And I said, that's a great idea. I never reported that back to Nick. Nick later on said, I got an idea. Let's do top three, bottom three. And I said, and eventually we pared that down to top three, bottom one. And it just so happened, much like Alan Moore and Frank Miller working on Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns, respectively, at the same time, mutual inspiration, unconscious inspiration, at the same time, simultaneously, from two different, not parts of the country, but two different parts of the area. So just one of those happy coincidences that happened.
Right, and of course, when he shared the idea with you, Greg, I believe what you had told me is that he you know, it was during a discussion where he called you up and he said, you know, Greg, I'm getting in the comic book podcasting business.
I didn't remember that part. That's true. He said, actually, the way I remember it, anyway, this is just my recollection of it. He said, Greg, I'm getting in the comic podcasting business. And I, of course, Nick, as you know, as I want to do, I said, well, Russell, I was quite calm about it. I said, that's fine. I'm not in that business. You see, Nick and I are in the comic book entertainment business. The graphic entertainment business, to be specific. And quite frankly, I never heard from him again.
Those are, of course, two different
Absolutely.
Businesses.
You see, comic book podcasts are what Nick and my fathers did. In addition to jumping into septic tanks.
Woo! And never mind.
And I also wanted to say, you know, while this rivalry has provided undoubtedly a boost in ratings, because after all, controversy creates cash, we do now have a reason to unite to put aside our petty differences with the Sellers Points podcast, which you can also catch right here at Place to Be Nation Pop, the only place to be in your pop culture world, pop. And that reason is, of course, hashtag Gotham sucks.
Gotham sucks. Why are we coming together about
frankly,
this? What happened?
Sometimes Russell and Kelly have taken some degree of fire for their negative opinions of the show Gotham on their recent podcast, and so I felt the need to throw our names into the hat of the hashtag Gotham sucks movement, which we were, of course, influential, shall we say, in the creation of.
Some might say that we were the ones to bring the concept to the masses, but once again, that's just
some
what...
Some might say, that's right.
Some might say.
Now, we've got a couple of other cool things coming up this month for Walking Dead Month. We've got a countdown of our favorite Walking Dead characters, drawing from all the different media iterations of Walking Dead.
Yes, all Walking Dead themed forms of entertainment are
book.
In play. Whether it be the comics, the television show, the video games, whatever you want to use, everything and everyone.
That's right. Even fan fiction, if we choose to go that route, you know, it's all up to the individual.
Given the nature of a lot of fan fiction, I think the idea of Walking Dead fan fiction scares me in ways that I don't want to be scared, Greg. So I'd prefer
that,
not to.
That's understandable. We'll look at that. And then, of course, we're going to end the month. I say of course, but we are going to end the month with our hot take review of the premiere of the newest season of The Walking Dead. It's going to be timely.
Yeah, full-length review of that, you know, kind of breaking down theoretically, hopefully anyway, the premiere will answer some questions.
God you know, help them from, if they don't, Nick. If they don't,
oh God, we will be here to rip the show a new one if they don't.
We are going ham on them if they don't answer the questions.
Quite frankly, folks, they don't answer them damn questions. You might say this podcast is going to get lit.
Is it bad that I kind of now hope they don't?
Dude, if they don't, like it, I told you, this is the shakiest footing the show's ever been on for me. And if they don't answer a couple of questions for me, I might
well,
be
it's
done.
Gonna, it's like, certainly going to lead to it. It would certainly lead to a unique podcast experience. Anyway, once we're done with Walking Dead Month, we'll get back into the normal swing of things. We're going to get back to our Hard Travelers for Hire, where we will be joined by Russell Sellers of the Sellers Points to talk about The Incredible Hulk. Is it incredible? We'll decide that, and we'll let you know.
Absolutely. And then we've got, you know, of course, a countdown coming up in the month of November, one that we had to delay, that will feature Mr. Ben Morse, the I've forgotten his title.
Yes,
Marvel.
He is like the digital creative.
He's really freaking important. That's all
officer,
you need to know.
He's a big deal, kind of a big deal, and he's awesome. And not to again tell tales out of skewl, but we already have that episode in the can, and part of the episode in the can, and it's really good. We were both really excited about that, about having Ben on the show. Be on the lookout for that. It's a great episode.
Absolutely. And then, of course, we've got a couple other things coming up in the month of November that I can't remember right
well,
now.
Well, so we also have another exciting event coming up, Nick, and I don't know if you've seen this, but pretty soon we're going to have the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic Tournament on our tickers because Ho-Ho Loon is back, and he is a part of
what?
The Dusty Classic,
what?
Yes. Ho-Ho Loon is teaming up with Ben Wong or whatever the guy's name is, and they are a tag team in the Dusty Rhodes Invitational. So we've got a new purpose.
Happy days are here again, Greg. The hopes of a nation have been resurrected.
Only to be dashed instantaneously. But, we don't know.
Nope.
He could very well win the whole thing.
Listen, we don't know, Greg. We don't know what might happen.
But anyway, we bring it to an end, folks.
Is the no good Noam Dar in this tournament?
Noam Dar is nowhere to be seen in this tournament.
Well, that's both a blessing and a curse. A blessing in that he won't have to get to crush our dreams twice, but a curse in that we won't get our long-awaited revenge.
Not yet, anyway. You got to figure if Ho-Ho can win this tournament, he's going to get his chance at revenge. At some point. So.
Absolutely. But in any event, we were trying to end the episode about 15 minutes ago, and we've rambled and rambled on. So we're going to let you go now, and we hope that you join us next time for another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys here in Walking Dead.
Yes.
Days when I could live my life without you. Feeling the fingertips, it's pulling at my Days when I couldn't live my life without you.